And you've had that car for several years now, right?
It's a 2014 car with 30,000 miles.
Yeah.
My kids complain that it still smells like a new car.
They complain? That's the best smell in the world.
That's what I say. Well, they're like, I don't like it.
What does it smell? I mean, does it actually smell like a new car or does it smell like shampoo? Like that's scented like a new car?
No, it's new car smell. It's not. The inside has never been shampooed. It's just mild new car smell. Because I don't let the kids destroy it, so it doesn't smell like their spilled chocolate milk and other things they've wedged into the seat and other gross stuff. Like it's a car mostly used by an adult who doesn't make a mess.
You? I'm surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, so we successfully made it through, I think, the majority of the snacking in the car age that our child went through without ever allowing him to snack in the car. And so none of our cars ever smelled like Cheerios or, you know, things that like little kid slash baby cars usually smell like. Because we just said, no, we're not allowed to eat in the car. And like, we'll eat when we get there or whatever. And we stuck to that, like even on long trips. And it was surprisingly easy. It was just like, no, you can't eat. Okay. And then we, you know, we ate when we got there. And as a result, my car never smelled like Cheerios.
Yeah, Aaron's car, it is relatively straightforward to clean out all the detritus that is everywhere, but it is chock full of detritus. And, you know, periodically I will clean out the inside and get it all out of there, but it's real bad. And she's better about it than me because, you know, she is fully aware that that is the family car and that that's what happens to the family car and so on and so forth. But I look at it and I'm just like, oh, God, what has happened in here?
Well, let me assure you, it is optional. You can say this is not going to be a snack car, and it doesn't have to be a snack car.
Well, the food comes back later because my kids now like want to like grab like an on the go breakfast on their way to like school or something. So they have like, you know, teenager food of, you know, cans of sparkling water and you know, random. I mean, even just fruit stuff or like yogurt. Alex is always bringing yogurt into the car on the way to school. He wants to grab a yogurt and eat it on the way, and so he's got a yogurty spoon sitting in like they. There's a middle period where there's not much food in the car, and then later they get old enough to just be like, I'm just bringing food in the car. I need a snack on the way to school because I didn't have time to eat breakfast.
And you're not getting in the car, or you're not getting breakfast because that's like yogurt is such a joke. Yogurt is just melted ice cream. Like
it's not melted ice cream.
Yeah, it's dairy and sugar. Margo
also doesn't know where food comes from.
No. Apparently yogurt not. Is basically it's like, you know, dairy plus sugar. It's easily spoiled. It's full of sugar, so it will be sticky, like, and be covered in bees pretty soon. Like, it's just, that's what happens. Like, yogurt is, it's fine when you're eating it, but it's not something you want ever going near your car. Like, no. Just let him bring in an ice cream cone. It's the same thing. Like, why, if you would allow yogurt, bring in an ice cream cone.
Most yogurt has slightly less sugar than ice cream.
You'd be surprised how little less. It's really quite similar. That's why the kids like it so much, because it's ice cream, basically.
I'd like to start the show, if I may, with Casey's complaints about his co-host corner.
Yes.
First of all, I would like to begrudgingly congratulate you, Game Respect Game. I was talking to somebody, shoot, I can't remember who it was now, but I wanted to refer back to the BMW that I had built for the post-show neutral last week.
And BMW has this wonderful feature where whatever build that you configure on their configurator gets a unique URL.
Right.
So that you can then copy and paste that URL, send it around, save it, refer back to it later, and it just has this like preset configuration of whatever you set it to.
Exactly right. And so I knew that I had put my configuration, quote unquote, my configuration in the show notes, and I wanted to refer back to it. And so I clicked on it in the, you know, I went to ATP.fm and I clicked on it and I saw a white BMW and I thought, oh, I must have clicked on the wrong thing. And I clicked it again and I saw the same white BMW, but it looked to this. Oh, well, okay, fine. Well done, you insufferable pain in my hindquarters. Well done, indeed. It took me a minute to realize the joke. And then I realized the joke, and I realized that Marco had swapped my Tanzanite Blue 7 Series for a white one. I was quite annoyed, and I was actually more annoyed at the quality of the joke than I was the fact that you had replaced my blue car with a white one. In fact, I respected the joke enough to... I went to actually replace the link with the correct one because I had the correct one still, and I thought, no, he earned this one. I'll let it sit. And so it is still the white one on ATP.fm. But rest assured, listeners, I had built a blue one, damn it.
This one just so happened to be white.
It happened to be white, Marco. It can just happen. Also, I'd like to complain about Mr. John Siracusa. You had mentioned offhandedly on Reconcilable Differences number 121, entitled Impotent Hydra, that you don't like Wegmans, and I would like you to defend yourself, sir, because this is blasphemy.
We've talked about this on this very show, I think. The one reason is that the Wegmans near me is in a very inconvenient location. It's on an annoying divided highway that's difficult to get to and always clogged, and then once you're on the side you want to get on, it's hard to get back on the other side. It's a mess. So that's a big reason why we don't ever go there, because even though it's not that far away as the crow flies, it is terrible to get to. And the parking's not great, and, you know, just everything about it. Second thing is, even if it wasn't terrible to get to, this is another one that's also even worse to get to, that's farther away, that's in a mall. It's kind of like Whole Foods, where we go all the time because we have Whole Foods close by us. But Whole Foods, like Wegmans, is... I mean, you know what they're like. Like, they're not like regular grocery stores. Whole Foods is worse than Wegmans in this respect. Where, you know, a regular supermarket that we're accustomed to, you can picture in your head of here are what the different aisles are, and here's what's in them, and here are the kind of products they have. Just a generic, straight up the middle American supermarket. Wegmans and Whole Foods have fancier stuff, different brands of things, lots of prepared foods, all sorts of stuff like that. And the environment is different. It's not just aisles of stuff with carts going back and forth. It's all these weird stations and areas and stuff like that. And when I want to go grocery shopping, I most of the time, unless there's something special that I want to get that I know I can't get at a plain grocery store, I just want the grocery store experience of going up and down the aisles and getting the stuff and everything being where I expected, and, you know, being able to find all the brands that I'm accustomed with, and but Wegmans doesn't fill that. So maybe if it was close, I would go there more than I go to Whole Foods. But I always feel like I'd have to go to multiple places, like a Wegmans/Whole Foods for weird specialty items or things that we know are better there or something we want to get that's fancy. And then a regular supermarket for regular supermarket stuff.
I am sort of playing a shtick here. I do enjoy Wegmans. They just in the last couple of years came to my area. I do like Wegmans actually most as a place to work. They have a really nice patio outside one of the local Wegmans near me. And additionally, they have quite a large, like, food court kind of sitting area inside as well. Large enough that if you just go and sit and do some work, that's not really unusual. And it's not, you know, nobody's looking at you like, why are you here? Get out. For those of you who don't know, Wegmans is a supermarket chain here in the States. I would say it's like John had said, more similar to Whole Foods than a traditional supermarket, but not quite all the way to like bespoke artisanal everything like Whole Foods is. But Wegmans, very expensive. My favorite vice, one of the things I enjoy to do for lunch occasionally is go to the Wegmans hot bar, where you get like a styrofoam or whatever container. It's probably not styrofoam, it's probably cardboard. But anyway, you get a cardboard, you know, to-go box, and you fill it with all sorts of different things. And of course, if you're like me, you want the really, really heavy things like mac and cheese. And then you go and you go to the checkout counter and they weigh your box, and it's so much per, you know, half pound or pound or what have you. And it is preposterous how much a single human being can spend at the Wegmans hot bar. I think I have spent like $15, $20 on my meal alone. And this is just like cafeteria food for all intents and purposes. It's very tasty cafeteria food, but consider your source. I have low standards. And so it is ridiculous how much you can spend at the Wegmans hot bar. And Whole Foods is just as bad, if not worse. But a lot of people are devout Wegmans fans. I definitely like it. It is very expensive, even for groceries, as far as I'm concerned. But it's a very nice store, and I enjoy it. And I just wanted to hear you defend yourself. And yeah, I can't really argue with anything you've said, unfortunately.
I can't believe that you go to the hot bar in a grocery store and get macaroni and cheese. That's basically the worst thing you can get there, because it is always priced by weight. And, you know, what you should really do is, I mean, there's like all sorts of hacks of like, you get like, you know, all sunflower seeds or whatever. And it's cheaper than buying sunflower seeds per pound or whatever. But like, you know, within the realm of like normal meals, I feel like a salad with a bunch of like stuff added on top, like sunflower seeds or like, you know, other nuts, things like that. Like, that's almost always a way better buy than anything that is inherently very dense and heavy, like, you know, baked potatoes or pasta.
Oh, no, I completely agree. Yeah, and that's why, well, we did this. There's a stretch of time when Wegmans was new that we were doing this like once every month or two. You know, the family would go for lunch or something like that. And over time, I realized I'm being an idiot. I need to get like salad with maybe a little kiss of macaroni and cheese on the side rather than an entire platter. Well, not an entire platter, but you know what I mean? Like, you know, a large portion of mac and cheese and then some other heavy thing next to it. And so, yeah, I completely agree with you.
I don't partake of any of the prepared foods. Like, I don't begrudge people them. Occasionally, if you're in a crunch and you don't have time to do anything, you can get them, but they're so expensive and everybody has sneezed on them and you have no idea how old they are. Like, it's just... just everything is aligned against them. Like, the main reason we go into our local Whole Foods, aside from it being very close by, is they do milk as a loss leader. So they actually have the cheapest milk in the area. So every time we, and it's a good idea because every time we want to go milk, we end up in Whole Foods. And then if our kids are with us, they make us buy like the $2 mochi, which are good, granted, but A, not that good, and B, they're $2. So
I have never found anything in like the grocery store hot bar to be worth getting a second time. And I will forget this about maybe once every 2 years, and I'll go get another like big lunch or, you know, a couple of lunches. Ugh. There. And every time I'm like, why did I do that? And why do it's actually very similar to the WBDC box lunch side dishes, where like you get something and you're like, you know, some kind of, you know, oh, here's like a side of, you know, macaroni salad or something, and you taste it and you're like, this is not anything like what I expected. And also somehow manages to taste like nothing, and yet is also not good.
And it's $8.
Yeah, and it costs you $8 if you're lucky. In reality, I'm usually closer to, you know, 12, you know, because I think I'm, you know, underweight, and then I get to the checkout and it's like, oh, that's $12. And afterwards, I'm like, I could have walked down the street to any like casual fast food place like a Chipotle or something and gotten a way better meal for less money than what I just spent at the stupid hot bar at the grocery store.
I actually think that Wegmans and Whole Foods both are tasty and decent food, but I completely concur that it is not worth the money that one would spend on it. We've gotten way off the rails already, and it's my fault, so let's just move right along. Why don't you tell us about what could have caused your iMac Pro's fan problems, Marco?
Actually, I have a small update on that.
Uh-oh.
All right, so first, let me do the the feedback item here. So we got feedback from Chris Harper, who says... I started my career as a technician in the entertainment department at a large theme park. One of my jobs was repairing broken equipment. Early in my training, I was told to never use the air compressor for blowing out electronics because air compressor tanks and even the hoses often get condensation in them, possibly due to the heat of the motor. Essentially, you'd be blowing moisture on your stuff. So you had to use canned air instead or vacuum them out using special electronics vacuums. And I think I heard it from a couple people on Twitter who also said that apparently air compressors can spray tiny drops of oil from inside themselves into electronics, which is obviously very bad, or little metal shards. I don't think any of that happened, and my air compressor is a very small consumer unit that probably doesn't have either. I can tell you I've never oiled it, and probably doesn't get hot enough to ever make condensation inside. So I don't think that was an issue here. However, after a few days of operation, my fan problem is back.
Uh-oh.
Now, I also heard, I forget who, I'm sorry, I have to look up. But
check the notes, which you are not following along in very well. Because Casey was prompting you to read the feedback from Tom Bridge, and you skipped several items down.
Yes, you did.
Oh, hold on. Up. Oh, there we go.
Is this your first day, Marco?
It is his first day looking at the show notes.
Lucky for you, I'm the editor. So we also heard from Tom Bridge, who said a second possible explanation for Marco's iMac Pro's reduced fan RPMs post-vacuum would be a reset of the system management controller, the SMC reset, which was accomplished when I unplugged my iMac Pro for more than 15 seconds. So this is a long-standing, like, you know, Mac kind of like, you know, spin around and fix the problem kind of thing that you try. You do a rain dance, you zap PRAM, and you reset the SMC. That's what this is. So the way you reset the SMC on any modern Mac is you cut off power for 15 seconds and you plug it back in and the SMC resets. And that is the component that is responsible for things like thermal management, fan speed, stuff like that. So that is much, because I said last episode I'm pretty sure that not a lot came out of it dust-wise. And I wasn't sure why it fixed it, because it seemed like it seemed like enough stuff didn't come out of it for that to be the problem. So if that indeed wasn't the problem, and if the SMC is just kind of getting buggy over time, which does happen with Macs sometimes, that's a much scarier outcome for me, because now the problem is back. I didn't have time to try this yet because I use my computer, so I didn't have time to unplug it for a while and play around today. But I am a little concerned that this just might be my life now, and if that's the case, I'm going to be very sad, because, again, one of the biggest reasons I love the iMac Pro is no matter what I do to it, I never hear the fans. And now I'm hearing the fans spin up and down on a pretty regular basis as I do like Xcode builds and stuff, and that's really not great.
Let it be known, listeners, that as we record, it is the evening of the 29th of January in the year 2020.
I have not yet ordered a Mac Pro. In fact, go to the next follow-up item and I'll tell you why that's relevant to me.
Well, let me just tell you, listeners, that I am putting it on the record that before WWDC, Marco will have a Mac Pro in his house. You've heard it here first. All right, tell me about why you're supposedly not getting a Mac Pro, Marco.
This is my item. He'll chime in after I explain what's actually in here, and I don't think it's actually relevant to his decision-making process. This is just a follow-up on the Pro Display XDR reference modes. We talked about them last time, of like what they're used for, and the P3 1600 nits versus 500 nits and all that stuff. Anyway, there is an official Apple, whatever they're called now, TechNote support article that explains all the different reference modes. There's many more than the ones we mentioned. So if you want to see them all and understand how they work and what they're supposed to be used for, you can check out the link in the show notes. The one interesting thing that I pulled from it is there's a section towards the bottom that's like, if you see this scary icon showing like a caution triangle exclamation point symbol next to a monitor that appears in the AirPlay menu, your Pro Display XDR might be in a low power mode and using limited brightness. This can occur if the ambient temperature of the room is 77 degrees Fahrenheit or higher, and your display has been at 500 nits or higher for a long time. Unplug your display from your computer, wait 5 to 10 minutes, then connect your display and try again. If the issue continues and the ambient temperature of the room is less than 77 degrees, contact Apple. The reason I think this is irrelevant to Marco is because I really don't think he ever keeps his house higher than 77 degrees. And he's also probably never going to have the monitor over 500 nits because he's not doing HDR video editing / mastering. So it's mostly irrelevant. And I can tell him, like I said when I first talked about this monitor, you cannot hear, or I cannot hear, the fans in the monitor. I'm assuming they're spinning right now, but I have never heard them other than when I shoved my ear against the back of the monitor when I was setting it up. And even then it was difficult. Still can hear the tower computer over there off in the distance a little bit, which is why I think still with your iMac Pro, it may be noisier under load than this. It is definitely noisier under load than this thing is, because this thing never changes sound whatsoever, but its constant noise level is higher than the idle noise level of an iMac Pro, which I basically can't hear. This I can always almost hear, and it just literally never changes volume at all.
Unfortunately, my iMac Pro was like that for a long time, and now isn't. So just wait, John. Wait until about year two or year three of your Mac Pro.
And we'll have a little bit more thermal overhead than you do, considering how vast my cooling system is and how little is actually in the box. Whereas I'm not on the ragged edge of anything. I really need to get, I think the iStat menus guy said they were updating their stuff to support the new temperature. They were going to send me a beta, and I don't think they sent me one.
Look at that. They're usually pretty fast.
I do want to see, like, do the fans ever go any faster, no matter what I do? Because, like I said, I can't hear them change, you know, volume at all, even when I do disk benchmarks, GPU benchmarks, CPU benchmarks. It's just, you know, playing even playing games in Windows, which I assume has, you know, doesn't really understand the fan control on this or whatever, like playing Destiny. Like, I don't know what I have to do to this computer to make it make any more noise. It just doesn't, because I've got the wimpiest video card and a fairly wimpy CPU and three gigantic fans plus a blower fan and almost nothing in that box.
Well, wait 2 years and then you'll see.
We'll see.
No, the reason why this Pro Display XDR, I would call it a overheating issue, maybe in a warm environment and running at full brightness. It sure sounds like that. Apple would never use that term, but that's kind of what this is. That you basically could have problems with the XDR retaining full brightness if you're running it in a room that's hotter than 77 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, I do that all summer long when I'm at the beach. One of the reasons I like being there is that while it is warm, it is not too hot. Like, it almost never hits above like 85 degrees, and there's a nice breeze. And whether or not there's a nice breeze, I can augment it with like a big ceiling fan. So I'm able to work very comfortably with breeze and or fan blowing on me up to the low 80 degrees, like up to like, you know, 80 to 85 degree Fahrenheit.
That's the temperature outside. Check the temperature in the room you're sitting in.
It's not going to be lower than outside.
I think if the room you were sitting in was 77 degrees or higher, you would do something about it.
You don't know summer mode, Marco. Got the breeze going.
Anyway, I don't think if you have the windows open and fans going in, it would be fine because you're not mastering HDR stuff. You're not going to have it over 500 nits. Put your monitor up to max brightness right now. That's not even 500 nits. You're never going to have it that bright.
How bright does the iMac Pro monitor go?
Not even up to 500, I don't think.
I think it might, and I keep it most of the time at about 75 to 80% brightness. In the middle of the day in the summertime, I might crank it up because the room will be brighter.
It's not a factor. It's like, all right, but I mean, you should try it, but I will be shocked because you're not doing HDR stuff. And you don't realize how bright 500 nits is. And if you have the windows open and the salt air is blowing in, corroding your monitor, it's, you know, this is only if you're like in a stifling room with no airflow that's over 77 degrees and you're doing things for a long period of time. We'll see, because, you know, I don't actually have whole house air conditioning or anything that's going to save this thing. So when summer comes in my tiny little stifling room that I'm actually in, we'll see if I ever have any issue. I can imagine that not only will I not have any problem, but I also will continue to not hear the fans in this monitor.
By the way, real-time follow-up, the iMac Pro does apparently have up to 500 nits brightness, as do the most recent MacBook Pros.
So what do you have yours set to now?
About 80%. And this is at night in the winter.
Well, so is it the room over 77 degrees, and has it been at 500 nits or higher for a long time? It's never been at 500 nits, because you never crank it to full brightness, probably. And the room is never over 77, because who keeps their house that hot if they can help it? And you have central air, so you can help it.
Yeah, but all summer long, I'm telling you. So basically, what this tells me is, I probably shouldn't buy a Pro Display XDR for the beach. Now, granted, I probably wasn't going to anyway, because it's so damn expensive. But again, that puts a pretty big thorn in the side of any possible Mac Pro plans. Like, because one plan would be get a Mac Pro and haul it back and forth and have a monitor at both places. But that now seems like an even worse idea than it did last summer when we were first talking about this.
I think it's very likely you're going to buy, like, pizza for the table. You're going to buy a computer for the house. I don't know what it's going to be yet. It could be a Mac Pro. It could be an iMac Pro. But this is going to be a computer for the house.
I don't think so.
Absolutely. You're going to get a computer for the house.
A monitor is very likely. Like,
everybody loves it when you get a computer for the house.
Like, I will almost certainly, like, if I don't haul an iMac Pro back and forth, which I think is still probably the best option, but if I don't do that, I would probably keep like an LG 5K out there and then whatever the heck my home solution was.
Computer for the house.
Imagine if you had ever had experience with the LG 5K at the beach house, you would know exactly what you're getting into.
I have.
That's my joke, Marco. Good God.
I spent a whole summer with it. It was really mediocre.
I know, but if you had it hooked up to a preposterously overkill Mac Pro, I think you would get over the mediocreness. Anyways, I think you're getting a Mac Pro. I think you will start by having an LG 5K at the beach. Don't you already have one at the beach right now at somebody else's house?
He buried it in the sand. It's marked with an X. Secret treasure.
Yeah, I stuck a kid's plastic shovel right above it so I could see like where, yeah, where it exactly is.
It'd be better if your name was Casey, because then it would be the secret of Casey's gold, but secret of Marco's gold doesn't have the same ring to it.
No.
In any case, I think that here's your future. Your future is in the next 6 months, you're going to be getting a Mac Pro, and I think you'll get a Pro Display XDR for your home in, I almost said your home in New York, for your home that you're sitting in right now. And then I think you will go to the beach, you will try to convince yourself that you can live with the LG, and then before you depart the beach from the end of the summer, you will have ended up ordering a second Pro Display XDR and put it at the beach house. That's my
goal. Wait until the newly redesigned iMacs with built-in 6K displays come in colors, and then we'll get whatever color matches whatever room that it goes into in the house.
See, now we'd be talking new, like, 6K iMacs. Now I'm very interested.
In colors. It's going to come in teal.
Yeah, but see, I'd be very interested, not because I would want two of them, because I would just replace my iMac Pro with the new 6K iMac Pro.
Getting two of them. I don't understand why you're resisting this. You're not going to keep plugging that thing back and forth. You're going to get two.
I honestly don't think he would get two.
Pizza for the table. It's gonna happen.
I honestly think that Marco will end up with two Pro Display XDRs, but I think there will only be one machine.
He's rapidly getting too old to be lugging a computer on his shoulder back and forth. Just wait.
But now I wheel it. It's easy.
Right.
Yeah, I'll see.
The funny thing is, like, it's probably an easier solution to just get a second iMac Pro.
That's what I'm saying.
That's both cheaper and easier than bringing a Mac Pro back and forth.
I didn't say what kind of computer it would be. I would just say there's going to be a computer for the house.
I can't handle this conversation. Can somebody please save me and tell me about True Tone?
No, because why are we having such problems with the notes today? You go from top to bottom. In this country, we read from top to bottom.
Oh, I'm sorry. I saw the Chris Harper and I went below it. God, we are disasters, especially me.
Well, some of us.
Is that especially me? Oh, my gosh.
You and Marco both have done technical fouls in the follow-up section.
All right. So I don't want to hear about True Tone. Never, ever. What I'd love to hear. Oh, God. See, this is I skipped it. My subconscious skipped it because I don't give a shit about a rack mount Mac Pro.
Did you watch the videos?
I watched like 4 seconds of it and I realized, I don't give a shit about this.
That's your YouTube attention span. All right. I'll handle this one so you don't have to. It's a quickie. We've been talking about the rack mount Mac Pro, which is available for sale. Someone put up a YouTube video of unboxing it and comparing it to his old setup. It was Neil Parfit. They're really good videos. They, you know, if you want to know what the deal is with the rack mount Mac Pro, it's you'll see it from every angle and learn all the features and learn how one person's actually using it. The interesting thing about it, I think, is when you see it, especially if you're familiar with the plain old tower Mac Pro, it is so clear that unlike the X-Serve, this is not a purpose-built rack-mount computer. This is a tower computer turned sideways and put into a weird case that kind of goes in a rack, which is fine. Like, you know, there's nothing terrible about that. But when you look at the X-Serve, which was absolutely purpose-built, share nothing with anything, like all new industrial design just for being in racks, it's so clear that Apple, at a brief time in the semi-distant past, was serious about making rack mount computers. I think with the Mac Pro, they're just realizing some pros, the situation in which they want to use a Mac Pro, they have a rack available. They don't want it to be freestanding. So can we make this tower computer rack mountable? And the answer is yes, and it looked fine, but it's not particularly space efficient. It is just a Mac Pro turned on its side with some, that's why there's like weird gaps and stuff inside the case. They did some interesting solutions for you to be able to get at the different stuff because, you know, the RAM is on one side and most of the other cards are on the other side, which makes sense when you have like the tower Mac Pro where you pull off the whole case and you have access to it from all sides. But the rack mount one is not like that. So it has a door on the top and then it has a second door on the bottom. It's like, why is that stuff on the bottom? Why didn't they just make everything accessible from the top? Because this is the tower Mac Pro turned on its side and that's the way the tower Mac Pro works. The interesting comparison, so there was the unboxing and everything. And there was a comparison of fan noise. And again, he was very impressed that it was very quiet. Neil was filling his thing with like almost every card slot filled because he does audio stuff and he's got all these weird audio interfaces. So he stuffed it to the gills and had all these power cables going everywhere. He was really happy with it because at the end of the second video, he shows, this is what this is replacing. I have this big, giant, whatever it is, 5U rack mount thing, which seems like it's really big, but it replaced, and he does a little cut in the video showing 2 trash can Mac Pros and a billion peripherals and like Thunderbolt docks and cables and everything. Just this giant mess of hardware all now fits inside this one box. So I think he was happy with it, even though I think that as a rack mount computer, it is a little ungainly and ugly. But it's clear that some people want exactly this. They do not want a tower computer. They want it to fit in a rack. So I'm glad Apple's making it, and I'm glad at least one person seems happy with it.
I feel better for having known this piece of information. Thank you, John.
You should watch the video. You can get to hear the cool little snick that the door makes when you take it off the side and click it back in. It's cool.
Just like Wolverine.
Yes.
Would you tell me about True Tone, please? Because I am oh so excited to hear about it.
This is Chris Harper chiming in on... Oh, no, that's not. That's the compressed air. Oh, now all three of us have done follow-up.
Here's how the show notes work, John. You read from top to bottom.
The instruction pointer is friggin'... No one knows where the instruction pointer is anymore. We're lost. We're lost in follow-up.
Oh, this is amazing.
Someone issued a jump statement, and now we have no idea where we are.
You are such a nerd. I love you. Right. Oh, God.
Christopher Bowers writes, regarding True Tone, as someone who works professionally in printing photos, the ideal situation is to have the room lighting and display white points be equal. That's why having True Tone on is the better, more accurate setting. So there's another person with some professional experience chiming in and saying, True Tone, yes, go for it, even if you're doing something that's important to color. And he also gives a link to ISO 12,646. I looked at that and I didn't. I think it's just, you know, well, here's the text from the thing. Specifies the requirements for two conformance levels for the characteristics of displays to be used for soft proofing of color images. Included are requirements for color uniformity and variations and electro-optical properties when viewing, with viewing direction for different driving signals. That's a lot of jargon. I think the standard is just basically saying how you should set things up to be judging photography on a computer device. It's hard for me to tell. That's a lot of jargon. Plus, they spell color with a U, so it's all very confusing.
Color.
Anyway. True Tone, endorsed by one person who is claims to be a professional. It's good enough for me.
Go team.
I was using it already anyway.
We are sponsored this week by Yes Please Coffee. This, I gotta say, this is not in the script. This is one of the only coffee things that I would ever recommend. I've used it myself for a long time, and it's fantastic. So there's a lot of productivity hacks, but there's one productivity tool that performs wonders for almost everyone. It's coffee. Yes Please is a coffee subscription service. It's Yes PLZ. They want to bring the very best roasted beans into your kitchen. So, you know, do you really need a coffee subscription? How often do you run out of coffee at home? True coffee fiends are pretty good about never running out, but you also know that scoring truly superb beans, especially reliably, can be hard. So, Yes Please, this is at yesplz.coffee, I love the domain, sources and roasts some of the finest stuff from all over the world. They also change it up every week, and then they deliver it to your door. So it says whole bean, very freshly roasted coffee, delivered weekly, fortnightly, monthly, or just whenever you need it. And you can pause and cancel anytime, no hassle. And you also get this cool monthly print magazine that they make featuring culture, food, music, and more. It's kind of fun. It's like a nice analog moment for your mornings in an increasingly digitally distracted world. So the founders of this, they have quite a strong background behind them. So it's from Tony Kinesny and Sumi Ali. They are veterans of coffee's third wave scene. You actually might know their previous coffee subscription business called Tonks. That's named after Tony Kinesny from back in the day. And these guys believe great coffee should not require much fuss. Making a perfect cup should be as easy as making a box of macaroni and cheese if you start with the best beans. And I can personally say I have used this service. I used it all summer long when I couldn't be home. Usually I'm a home roaster, but there's a lot of times when I'm too busy or I'm not home for a while. And whenever that's the case, I go to Yes Please. This is actually the coffee service I use when I want to buy beans. Go to Yes Please, that's yesplz.coffee. Use offer code Marco Sent Me, all one word, to get 25% off your first shipment. Upgrade your morning coffee game and you'll upgrade your whole day. Thanks a lot to Yes Please for making amazing coffee and sponsoring our show.
Why don't you tell me why you don't understand Xcode, please?
This is about the rant last episode about me trying to do GUI layout in Xcode using the various systems. A lot of people offered advice. A lot of people offered commiserations, saying that a lot of things I said were familiar to them, even people with lots of experience, that, you know, some of these problems are just sort of long-standing problems, and yes, you do sort of get better at dealing with them and come up with techniques for them. I want to call out Alex Kent in particular, who gave a video demonstration of him basically laying out my dialog box in Xcode. And I think that was important because, like, lots of people sent, like, here, look, I made your dialog box with Swift UI. I made it with Xcode. I made it with this. I made it with that. See how nice it is? Look, it looks just like yours. First of all, a lot of people who sent those in, I applaud the effort, but many of them didn't actually look like mine. It was kind of the point of, like, yeah, you can get 90% of the way there, but then if you want to get it pixel accurate, it's a little bit trickier than you might think, but whatever. But Alex's video let me see how he uses the tool to build it. First, it was refreshing to see him run into many of the things I complained about in real time when he was doing it, and then deal with them, and then let's say, okay, well, this is going to happen when you try to use this tool. Here's how you deal with it, right? So that was very helpful. Just kind of the mindset of what things you should bother doing and what things you should let the tool do for you was helpful to see that. Anyway, we'll put a link to the video so you can check it out. It's kind of long, but if you've never used Xcode to do layout before, like, there are a lot of different tools available to you, a lot of different systems, a lot of different ways to use the tools. And he demonstrates one particular technique. You don't necessarily have to do what he does, but I think it was eye-opening to see someone else's workflow. I think the most useful advice he gave me, and this is one thing that a lot of, I didn't mention last show and I should have, and a lot of people writing with advice were also not taking account for. I was, maybe foolishly, maybe not, aiming for a situation where I have no warnings, because Xcode does these little yellow warning symbols in the sidebar if you have any layout issue, if it thinks you have any layout issues. And always my goal was no warnings, because my whole project is built no warnings, you know, warnings or errors, all, you know, I do, it's got to be clean, right? Same thing with the layout. So if I got a layout, it was very easy for me to get a layout that I think was mostly correct and mostly looked correct, but it had 1,000 warnings on it. So that was part of what I was banging my head against. Even when I thought I went over the finish line, like, there, finally, everything's lined up. Let me run the app. Let me look at it. Let me measure with Xcode. Boom, everything's lined up. And then I would look in the sidebar, and there's 800 warnings. And I'm like, oh, what do I have to do to make you happy, Xcode? What are you complaining about? And I had all these complaints. This doesn't have an X position. I'm like, it doesn't have an X position? Are you kidding me? It has an exact distance from the thing that it's next to, which has an exact distance to the edge of the superview. That's like, it can't be anyplace else X-wise. That's, but it was like, no, I need an X position. I was like, what do you want from me? And they have all these things like add missing constraints, or, you know, up, like all these. And if you try to do that, it just throws constraints all over the place and it makes this big mess. So that was part of my frustrations. I'm trying to get to Zaro Boogs. I'm trying to get to zero warnings in Xcode. Right. And, Alex had this one particular piece of advice, which I had not figured out on my own, which was very helpful for the localization warnings. Like, it'll warn you, oh, you have a field that's like a fixed width. If you try to localize that text, the German word's going to be longer and it's not going to fit. And like, all right, one way you can deal with that is you can just somehow, I don't know how to do this, but somehow I'm told that you can convince Xcode that you're not going to do localization and it'll shut up about that. But I don't want to like close the door to localization. Who knows? Maybe it will localize someday. But I do want Xcode to shut up. And I want those warnings to go to the sidebar. So Alex says, for localization fixed width warnings, they can be fixed by making the width constraint priority lower than the content compression resistance horizontal priority. So the auto layout constraints have priorities, and like the maximum is 1,000, and you know, you can do in one number increments, right? So a lot of the defaults are like, this has a priority of 1,000, this has a priority of 750. If you make the width constraint have lower priority than that compression resistance, what that means is that, yeah, the width will try to keep it at this width, but if the contents are too big and the compression resistance, like the resistance of the contents to be squished or be clipped, is a higher priority than the width one, it will win. And even though the width is supposed to be 10, because the content is too wide, it will bust itself out and make itself 11 or 12 or whatever. And just by setting, you know, it doesn't actually change the layout because, again, I'm not localizing. But just by changing those priorities to be just, you know, one different from each other in either direction, you can get it to get rid of those warnings. And that, I think, was the final thing that I really needed to get over the hump. So when I was I'm working on my other app that has a Swift UI thing, it also has a regular storyboard, like I said. And after watching his video and learning about that trick, I went back to that dialogue and relayed out the whole thing with auto layout. And it was, I'm not going to say it was painless, but I feel like now I have a system. Now I feel like I can look at a setup and figure out, okay, I can defeat auto layout and make a layout that looks the way I want, uses auto layout everywhere, and has no warnings, now that I know these various tricks. So thank you, Alex. And I recommend everybody check out the video just to see how one person gets it done.
That is just, it's so ridiculous that you have to jump through so many weird hoops like that. And the tools are not making that easy or intuitive.
There are some features in the tool that I was avoiding. Like, Xcode will offer to fix a lot of stuff for you. Like, it's super helpful. It's like, do you want me to fix this? Do you want me to fix that? And it does. Like, I can imagine the people doing these UIs, like, what more do we want to do for you? You know, the people who authored this in Xcode, we give you, not only do we tell you what's wrong, but we give you like every conceivable reasonable option on how to fix it and explain what they each mean and let you pick from it in like a popover. And they do. But the problem with that is you look at that and you're like, well, which one of these do I want to do? I mean, these all sound like they might fix it, but then you pick one and it has this cascading series of other consequences for your layout that you don't quite understand. And then you're like, did I pick the wrong one 2 steps ago? I'm not sure what to do. Right. So I think the key is knowing which one of those tools to partake in. So if you watch Alex, what he does with the video, which I think he's maybe doing intentionally just to show like how the tools can help you, is he chucks a bunch of controls onto the canvas willy-nilly and then just makes a bunch of layout constraints using the, you know, the right-click drag shortcut thing instead of going the long way. And then just makes all the constraints. And then the feature he uses a lot of is misplaced items. The sidebar will say a bunch of items are misplaced, which means that you put some things on the canvas and you put a constraint that said this should be 10 pixels from that, but it's not 10 pixels from that. It's not even close to 10 pixels from that. That's a misplacement.
And then you just hit the fix button, right?
Yeah, it will fix the misplacement for you. And that one is one of the least destructive ways you can accept its health. Because the other ways are like, do you want me to add missing constraints? I don't think I ever do want you to add missing constraints, because what
you never want that.
Yeah, the constraints you think are missing, they're not actually missing. You're just, you know, whatever. But the fix mix placement will essentially move things on the canvas for you based on your constraints. So if you put a big jumble of items and you just do a bunch of constraints and then you just fix mix placements, they all spring into where more or less where they're supposed to be, and then you can fine tune. So that feature seems like a safe feature to use, and I found myself using it more. Like once you're in auto layout mode, you don't have to do that single pixel alignment stuff. My problem was always that like when I did auto layout, I could never get the layout to look right when it actually ran the window, and I could never get all the little warning stuff to go away until I started, you know, I was chasing my own tail. I was like, well, if I do this and fix that and this warning goes away, but this other one comes, I finally get all the warnings away, and I had this ridiculous series of constraints that made no sense and didn't put things where I wanted them. But I'm doing better now.
So are you a fan of auto layout at this juncture? Are you anti-auto layout? Where do you come down on that?
See, I've been watching literally years of auto layout videos at WWDC at presentations, like in person and on video. So I'm not unfamiliar with auto layout.
Sure,
more or less sold on the idea that auto layout is a cool thing. And I heard all the complaints when auto layout first came out and people's frustrations with it or whatever, but I hadn't actually used it myself. So going to use it myself, I was already bought in of the idea of like, I understand springs and struts. I understand the system, and people complain about the system, but I know there were bugs about the constraint solver or whatever, but it's better now, and I mostly buy into it. But I was so frustrated by my own sort of part of it is not my own desire to get rid of all those little warnings, right? A lot of the warnings I didn't agree with, and I'm like, there must be a way to get down to zero warnings, and I was just chasing my tail, right? Now that I, A, have that one fix with localization thing in my back pocket to address those without screwing up my, without like adding more constraints, right? And B, sort of know how to use the minimum number of constraints to get what I want done and how to address the complaints if it says, oh, I need this. Like sometimes it still complains that it doesn't have like an exposition and I'm like, you do have an exposition, but I know how to give it now a redundant constraint to shut it up, right? I think I mostly prefer it to springs and struts, even for static layouts and especially for resizable layouts. So I don't say I like it, but I think I've made friends with it. And I think if I had to make it, if I have to make a new view, I'm going to try to use auto layout first. Like that's my first choice now.
We are sponsored this week by Linode, my favorite web host. Whether you're working on a personal project or managing an entire enterprise's infrastructure, Linode has the pricing, support, and scale you need to take your project to the next level. They have 11 data centers worldwide now, including their newest one in Sydney, Australia. All of these feature enterprise-grade hardware. They now have an S3-compatible storage option and their next-generation network. So Linode delivers the performance you expect, but at a price that you don't. Get started on Linode today with a $20 credit for our show, and you can get access to their native SSD storage, a 40-gigabit network, industry-leading processors, their revamped cloud manager built with an open-source single-page app, and all their servers give you root access to your server along with their new API version 4 to automate things. They have a Python CLI if you want. I actually use that myself to set up my servers really quickly. They now have these Nanode plans that start at just $5 a month that currently gets you 1 gig of RAM on that server. And they have all sorts of plans above that no matter what your needs might be. They have something for you. So they have specialties like dedicated CPU plans, GPU compute plans for machine learning, video processing, AI, block storage, object storage, one-click installs of the most popular apps, including WordPress, the LAMP stack, and things like Minecraft servers. So you can get all this Linode. I have all of my servers hosted there. All of Overcast and Market.org are hosted at Linode. And I'm just so happy. I've been a customer for theirs for more than, I think, 8 or 9 years now. And it's just been wonderful the entire time. I have used a lot of web hosts in my career, and Linode is by far my favorite one. See for yourself by going to linode.com/ATP and using promo code ATP2020 to get a $20 credit towards your next project. And also, they're hiring. Linode.com/careers if you want to find out more about that. Otherwise, once again, linode.com/ATP, promo code ATP2020 for $20 in credit. Thank you so much to Linode for hosting all my stuff and sponsoring our show.
I want to come back to this if we have time a little bit later, but I genuinely have been excited to record this episode because I am hoping that we will be able to hear a tale of discovery, of misery, of excitement from Mr. Marco Arment. Marco, you have been working on something. You were banging your head against the wall. Hopefully there are no marks left on your forehead. What's been going on, man?
I've been trying to write an audio app in iOS 13.
That's a mistake. Why would you do that?
I've had a lot of challenges with the latest version of Overcast in beta. I spent the last week or so basically issuing 1 to 2 new builds a day trying to chase down this crazy problem that I was having with my AV audio engine-based playback engine. Sometimes, for some people, audio would not play when the screen was off. You could send the app to the background. All of that would be fine. Like, so it would do background playback. But if you turned off the screen to your phone, it would pause. And the second you turn the screen back on, it would unpause. So it's not that the app was crashing, because it wouldn't unpause if that was the case. And it's not that the app didn't have background audio capability. If that was the case, it would not play in the background at all, even with the screen on. So that wasn't the issue. The issue was, if the screen was off, this would be the problem. Now, I tried a whole bunch of different stuff. First of all, I suspected, like, maybe my AV audio session is not getting correctly the fact that I have an active session, or that it's, you know, that it's a long form session or whatever. So I did all sorts of tricks with the AV audio session, like trying, like, not deactivating it ever, trying to, you know, activate it every time I hit play, and then checking it, you know, polling it to see if it was getting deactivated or whatever. I tried so many things with the audio session manager, and I wasn't getting anywhere with that. Then I realized, or I remembered rather, when I wrote Overcast's original audio engine, which is still what you're hearing this through if you're playing an Overcast, if my new update hasn't been approved yet, there was this issue that if you run an AU graph, which is Apple's old audio framework for audio units, if you run an AU graph and you want it to be backgroundable, there's a certain property that you have to set on all the audio units in it that is documented only by this one tech note. It's like one, like Q&A 1606, something like that. And there's this maximum frames per slice setting. Because the idea is that when you're, you know, pumping audio through an audio graph, like there's like this real-time audio thread that requests a certain number of samples every time it calls back your function. Your function has to give it that number of samples. And usually that number was either 256 or 512. And so it was calling your function every 512 samples. Now keep in mind there's 44,000 of these per second most of the time. So it's calling this function a lot. When the screen turns off, the phone switches to a lower power version of this, where instead of requesting smaller blocks more frequently, it starts to request much bigger blocks, so it doesn't have to poll you as often, so the CPU can be in a lower power state more of the time. And so it starts, instead of asking for 512 or 256, it starts asking for, I believe, 4096. And if you didn't set this property on all your audio units that was barely documented, welcome to Core Audio. if you didn't set this property to at least that 4096 number to say, like, what's the maximum number of audio samples I can provide you at once, this exact problem would happen. If you turn the screen off, your audio would just pause. And then you turn it back on, it would unpause. The challenge of this to me is that once you have an AV audio engine type API, you can't set that property anywhere. There's nowhere where you can do that. What was extra weird is that, you know, if you do that wrong with an AU graph the old way, it fails every time. You can reproduce it 100% of the time in development. Just turn your phone screen off and it pauses. You're like, oh, I got a problem. You can fix it, and you can see if your fix works. But this is an intermittent problem I was having. It never happened to me once. I could not get it to happen in development at all. But every beta build I would send out, I would get a large number of people saying within a few hours of it going out, this is happening, this is still happening, this is still happening. So the only way I had to test whether my fix was working was to issue a new build to all the beta testers, send it out to, like, you know, thousands of people, hope many of them install it, and then look at feedback 8 to 12 hours later and see how many people were saying this and still is feedback. And so I was just, like, blindly shooting in the dark here. And eventually I found... So based on that hunch of maybe it was related to that old tech node, I eventually found there's a property on AV Audio Session where you can tell it what latency duration to use, basically. Like, you can set your preferred I/O buffer. And if you set it to something, it effectively disables the automatic switching between more blocks, less blocks. So I just set it to exactly 8192 samples, which is twice the old 4096. I set it to exactly that number, and the problem vanished. So I think I have solved this problem. I have not gotten any reports of it, or at least many. It's gone from, like, a ton to, like, two or three. So it seems like I think I have fixed it. And... oh my goodness, it's been quite a ride. So anyway, that's a long, long, long story to say. There's this crazy audio bug in iOS 13 that happens sometimes to some people. I think I have fixed it in this version of Overcast that might be out. That might be out by the time you listen to this. And oh god, this is the kind of thing that just crushes my morale, because, like, it's so frustrating. I mean, I'm sure all developers go through this. Like, when you have a bug and you just, not only can you not reproduce it, it doesn't even make sense that it could happen. And then you go through all these crazy difficult tricks and tests and logs trying to figure out how the heck can this possibly be happening. And then eventually you try some really obscure thing. And I think this worked, but I'm like, first of all, it's frustrating that I can't be sure that it worked. And it's extra frustrating that, like, there's this weird undocumented thing or barely documented thing. What hope does anyone else have of ever figuring this stuff out? Like, I happen to know, from having written this old audio engine 5 years ago, I happen to know that there was this little weird thing in the API that you had to do to make it background properly. Had I not known that, I never would have figured this out. There's nothing on Stack Overflow. Like, there's nothing anywhere that's useful. There's one discussion thread on Apple forums that references this Q&A, which is how I eventually found it. I can't overstate how important it is that Apple document their damn APIs. Like, so much of Apple development, you're shooting in the dark here, and the documentation is either wrong or incomplete or just totally missing. Audio is definitely one of those areas where, like, there's almost no documentation for audio, and what's there is usually incredibly incomplete. And the errors that you get are usually incomprehensible to the non-existent. Weird stuff happens, like, the main thread will get blocked for, like, 5 seconds by a random audio call to, like, start playing audio. Like, it's just weird stuff happens with the audio subsystem. And then whenever there's a new OS version or a new beta season, audio gets really messed up. I don't know why. Like, it doesn't seem like the kind of thing they would be changing often, but they do change it often. And some of it makes sense. Like, you know, when they launch new things like AirPods, and, you know, you got to have all the support in place for that, and stuff like the audio sharing and AirPlay 2. Like, they do a lot of stuff in the audio realm. But the audio subsystem is so buggy and so undocumented and so just, you know, bad at reporting errors, and the tooling around it is non-existent, so it's hard to even test most of these error cases. Like, it's so hard to make an app that just plays audio reliably. The audio APIs on iOS are so incredibly difficult to work with, for unnecessary reasons, you know, things like bugs and documentation problems. Not the APIs themselves. They have some problems, but they don't have major problems. I would never have guessed when I set out to write an audio app that I would be fighting the platform so often.
I would imagine that the common case is that they use whatever it is, AV Audio Player, like the super high-level API, which is like, don't you worry about audio. You just tell us what you want to play, and we'll handle all the details, and no, you can't control anything about it or have limited control, but don't worry, we'll get it done. Like, that I feel like is probably the most, you know, the paved road, as they say, for for audio, obviously you are going off the beaten path. You want to get at the guts. You want to get right in there. You want to make your own engine. You want to have total control over the whole stack. And then you are essentially working with the guts of their system, which, you know, it doesn't surprise me that they're totally undocumented and buggy and weird, because they're like, oh, well, no one's going to ever, and I know they're public APIs. I know you're not using private APIs, but they're like, well, no one's going to ever use these things. I mean, who knows if they even have tests for them or what or how they would test it. They're like, as long as our top level front door, just please play an audio file for me, as long as that works fine, we'll test that and make sure that mostly works. But anyone mucking around in the internals, like, and you don't have the source code to it, right? So if they're like, oh, I could write a good audio engine because here next to me is the source code to the audio system and I can see how it's all working and I can step through it in a debugger and say, oh, I see what the problem is. I see right here there's this conditional saying, oh, if you've just gone into the background and changed the buffer size and do it, like you'd see that if you were working at the on the guts. You're working with the guts, but you don't have access to the guts. So you're just like fumbling around in the dark saying, does this work? Does this work? This thing's not documented, but it seems like it has these functions, and I guess you're supposed to use them this way, right? Like, if you could just see, like, the comments above that function to be like, oh, here's what you got to do with this, and keep in mind X, Y, but you can't see any of that. It's just a bunch of binary libraries. So I feel your pain. But, yeah, and it doesn't, you know, lobbying for them to make that better is probably much more difficult than if you said, like, oh, I just tried to play an audio file with your top-level audio API, and it didn't work.
Yeah, well, and it goes beyond just, you know, that I'm using special APIs. It's also, in a lot of cases, it's really hard to tell if it's even my bug, because iOS 13 in general has had a lot of audio bugs. Like, I find even just, like, switching in and out of AirPods or, like, I find bugs in the music app, trying to play music, you know, between itself or HomePods or, again, AirPods, like, switching devices, CarPlay. There's so many problems that are audio related in iOS 13, not to mention all of iOS 13's other issues. Like, for instance, I still have to go back to the all inboxes list in Mail and then back into the inbox to refresh messages sometimes. And I don't know. I don't know why Apple thinks it's okay to break the Mail app so often, but they do. But they also seem to break audio very often. And so it's hard. Like, I don't even know if this is my bug or not sometimes. A lot of times, like, you know, if the audio engine just hangs and I've given it the exact same conditions that I've always given it, and this time it hangs and last time it didn't, like, how am I supposed to know, is this my issue, or is this, you know, that person's phone had a weird little glitch with iOS 13.1 point whatever, and that's actually an OS issue? It adds to the massive, like, rippling effects of iOS 13 being such a buggy release. Like, it puts a huge tax on developers all year long, because we have to also fight around the bugs with our own apps and try to figure out, like, first of all, is this our bug or is it not our bug? And if it's not our bug, do we have to work around it somehow anyway because Apple's not fixing it?
Which framework is all of this stuff in? Is this Audio Toolbox or AV Foundation or none of the above?
It's kind of, there's a lot of overlap there. Most of this that I've been telling you about is AV Foundation, but under the hood, it uses a bunch of Audio Toolbox stuff.
Well, but Marco, AV Foundation is 88.2% documented as per no overview available. Surely there's almost nothing missing.
Well, and the great thing is, you know, a lot of times this won't be measured correctly, because most of these functions actually do have official, like, sentences to describe what they do in the documentation. They're just incredibly incomplete and sometimes wrong.
Oh, yeah, no argument. I'm snarking. But, you know, no overview available was done, I believe, by Matt from NS Hipster, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. But anyways, it we've talked about it in the past, but it just visually shows you how god-awful Apple documentation has become over the last few years. And I'm assuming it was better in the past. Maybe it wasn't. But there's a lot of stuff here that is just really, really poorly documented. And I have been whining and complaining and moaning and kvetching to anyone who I know inside Apple who will listen to me, which is basically nobody. I know a lot of people that don't listen to me, saying, this is bull. This is awful. Like, I can't do my job as effectively as I want because you guys, for political reasons, for I don't know, I don't know what it would be other than political reasons. I mean, they have enough people, they have enough money. I know that there are teams working on documentation, but somehow it never makes it out. And just pointing to a WWDC video and saying, there's your documentation, is obnoxious at best and just plain wrong at worst. I don't know. It's this is a bugbear that's really been driving me nuts recently. And I ran up against this as recently as earlier today. And so I've got a real bee in my bonnet about it. But it's just so frustrating. Like, I guess maybe ultimately the problem is that I think of myself as more important to Apple, not me, Casey, but like developers, third-party developers is more important to Apple than we really are. But you would think for a company that wants to provide really robust, well-done APIs, and often does, yet they don't spend the time to actually document anything. And to your point, Marco, half the time it's documented, it's incompletely documented or wrongly documented. It's just unfair. Like, I know I'm kind of whining right now, but it's just plain unfair.
Well, and I think it speaks to a bigger problem of, like, the technical foundations of this company are rotting. This is a company that is doing way too much and is pushing way too hard on the new stuff and is not allocating its resources properly to keep things at a high quality level. And that this goes all levels of the company. This goes from, you know, from like the front end apps. Like, I was complaining last week about how they haven't really designed good UIs in a long time. Their design is all over the place and they seem to not have time or the care to lead that correctly. And then this also goes for things like software quality and API stability and documentation and like and the released OSs. This is all related. This is all the company not being able to keep up with itself. And this is an entirely self-created problem. It's management problems. It's like how you allocate resources, what kind of timelines you set, how you decide when to release something versus when not to. This is all within their control, and it's not being balanced well right now at all, and it hasn't been for years. And I don't know how to fix that because I don't know enough about, you know, their internal workings or their people or whatever. I don't think this is just a purely like, oh, fire Tim Cook kind of problem. Like, I think it's probably more complicated than that, but this is ultimately on management and leadership to fix. Like, it's about allocating resources and setting deadlines and choosing what to focus on and how to and what's important to you. And it seems like software quality is not important enough to them at all. And that goes to everything from documentation to the APIs to the OSs to the software itself.
I think one thing, I don't know if we talked about this in our last previous conversations about Apple's software strategy and stability problems and their release cadence and all the other stuff. But it occurs to me, partly part of the conversation that's been happening this past week about the 10th anniversary of the iPad, which we probably won't get to talk about today, but
oh, we should,
which has been cycling around, that different products, you know, are at different points in their lifetime, different Apple products, and even if they start at the same time, they might progress at a different time, and during the various life stages of any product or product category, different strategies are appropriate. And at this point, with the iPhone in particular, even though it is still, you know, the majority of Apple's business and by far their biggest product and super important and everything like that, the category of smartphone has slowed down progress and innovation wise as compared to, you know, a decade ago or whatever. Like, in the beginning, we went, you know, if you look at the first iPhone up to the iPhone 4, it's like, whoa, like, there's some big changes hardware and software wise. And at this point, software wise, if you look across the entire market, there are important new software features that you have to have. Photography, Face ID was important or whatever. But in general, the pace of change of smartphone operating system software and sort of platform features has slowed significantly. And so I feel like it is an appropriate time for Apple to consider leaning more towards the iOS 12 strategy of, like, let's just keep making what we have faster and pick one or two or three important new features that are required to stay ahead in the industry or keep pace in the industry, but not feel like, you know, iOS N plus one has to advance on all fronts every time, because that's just not the nature of the smartphone market anymore. I don't think there's pressure to do that. And I think the internal pressure, the sort of self-imposed internal pressure of like, the next iOS has got to be better in every way and have all new features and subsystems. That's not what users want. That's not what the market demands. And it's not required to stay ahead. And it is actually detrimental to staying ahead, because what's required to stay ahead is one or two or three really important new features that advance, probably with some hardware component. That's important to keep doing. Like, don't just say, okay, well, it's done and we never need to anything. You'll never get Face ID that way. And Face ID was important, right? So pick the where you're going to advance. But then all the other stuff, you're like, do we need to change this? Is this one of the tentpole features of the new OS? If not, let's dedicate all those resources to an iOS 12 strategy of refinement, fix bugs, make it faster, document, do all the things that you supposedly never have time to do. And that should sort of be the default. And then only a few things are blessed in each major release as the, you know, this is going to be where we're making some big advances. These are going to be our big customer-facing marketing features. I haven't been keeping up with the rumors for iOS 14. I did hear briefly in some story that there was some rumor that it was going to support all the same phones as 13. And it immediately made me think/hope, like, oh, maybe that means 14 is going to be more like 12 again, where they'll try to sort of regroup and make everything less buggy and faster. Yeah, there was nothing in the one headline that I saw that indicated that, but the fact that I was hoping that that was the case makes you feel like that's at least what I want as a consumer, is when iOS 14 comes out, I want it to be a no-brainer update that is as stable as iOS 12 was and is as pleasing as iOS 12 was. Oh, everything's a little bit faster and there aren't any weird bugs and maybe there's one or two new cool features I want. That, I think, is appropriate for the smartphone market. And it came up in the context of the iPad, because the iPad is in a very different place. The iPad's pace of innovation has been slow, and there is tons of room for major new advancements in that area. So I think the strategy for iPadOS, which now has its own name, but unfortunately under the covers is very much iOS, but slightly different. I don't know how they square that, but like, iOS needs to make some major advances. Maybe not competitive pressure-wise, but just product-wise. Because the tablet market is different than the phone market, because the tablet market has not blossomed and matured and had this sort of, you know, competitive pressure to evolve through competition to what the smartphone market has. And since those are basically both the same OSs under the cover, it's difficult to strike that balance. But hey, they did give it a separate name, and I'm perfectly fine if they fork off from each other and continue advancing that way. And also because most of the features on the iPad that the iPad needs to deal with shouldn't require major guts redesigns, I hope. And I don't actually know. Like, maybe there is something that needs to be done to the guts to mess with that. But all right, that's my thinking on the software quality, and in particular on the phone and iOS. That I'm not going to say it's time for Apple to slow down or the time to Apple to give up or whatever, anything like that. I'm just saying that, like, they may not be choosing the right strategy for each of their products' particular stage. It's like picking dog food for your dog. Like, what life stage is your dog in? You know, you get the puppy chow, you get the, what is it called, like the geriatric dog chow, you get the adult dog chow. I think it's time for the iPhone to have the adult dog chow.
There seems to be this disconnect between the pace of change and feature evolution and new stuff that Apple keeps doing and what customers actually want and need. And, you know, iOS... So another thing that I'm doing in this Overcast release is here now, like, you know, 4 or 5 months after iOS 13 launched, I'm restoring support for iOS 12 in this release because not enough people have updated to iOS 13 and adoption seems to have flattened out pretty significantly. So we're standing at something like 75% adoption, depending on how you measure it. And that's good, but it's not good in the sense that a quarter of the user base seems to not want iOS 13 at all. That's bad, in the sense that if you want your app to run on 25% of devices, which is not a small number, you can't use all this new stuff yet because iOS 13 has been such a botched release with bugs and everything like that, that, like, you know, people are avoiding it and like holding on to 12 the same way I'm still not on Catalina for all the same reasons, because, you know, I'm holding on to whatever the heck this is, High Mojave, whatever I'm running. And like, and so what Apple's customers want is not, you know, new ways to pose Animoji with faces and glue them together with iPad drag and drop. Like, no. What Apple's customers want is reliable phones and good battery life and good performance on their older stuff. When you introduce something like iOS 13, like, yeah, there's some fun new stuff in it here and there, some nice features, but there's a big price to pay in the much more important stuff of everything needs to work well. And again, to a lot of people, it has to work quickly on old phones, and it has to support their old phone to begin with, and stuff like that. And if they're falling down on those fronts, nobody cares about the new features. And we have the series of releases now where it seems like the new features are less compelling than ever, at the same time that the basics are getting screwed up more often than ever. And that's dangerous. That shows that, like, things are not being managed correctly. Like, this is a problem. I don't know whose problem it is or how to solve it, but this is ultimately a management and a resource allocation and release planning type problem. And it doesn't seem like Apple is taking this seriously. It doesn't seem like they're actually making changes. Like, we hear rumors about, like, you know, Federighi having memos or meetings where they say they're going to, like, you know, get better. But what have they actually changed to make that happen? Are they not going to release every year anymore? Are they going to cut back significantly on new features? Are they going to, you know, make the old OS run on new hardware? Who knows? It doesn't seem like they've actually changed anything. It seems like all they've done is say they're going to get better. But we haven't heard anything about actual changes that have actually happened that would be material to that. So that I'm still very much concerned about. You know, anybody can say I'm going to get better, but without actually changing significant things that will enable that change, I don't know how that's ever going to happen.
Well, they did iOS 12, which shows that they can do a release like that. Of course, we don't have any transparency, so we don't know, like I was saying. Is iOS 14 on an iOS 12-like path, or is it not? We're not going to find that out until basically they announce iOS 14, and then they'll either brag about the fact that they concentrated on performance and stability enhancements, or they won't, and we'll have to surmise from what they say publicly whether it was like that.
They're going to say that anyway, because 13 had a bad reputation. The same way, like, iOS 11 had a bad reputation, which is why iOS 12's marketing message was basically, we're focused on stability and performance, because 11 was a mess.
But they did, though. But they did. In 12, I feel like they succeeded in that strategy of giving a stable OS that has fewer features that was far less buggy than 13 for sure, and also than 11. And it was generally a well-received OS. Customers liked it. People upgraded to it. It was stable. It did what they said. It wasn't just marketing BS, right? So, but we didn't know that until 12 basically was announced. So if Apple is doing that now, we're not going to know about it because they're not going to tell us about what they're doing internally. But I think when iOS 14 is announced, they'll tell us. And 13, they didn't make the same pitch as 12. 13, it was like, look at all these new features. The pitch was not, we really regrouped them, or we're mostly concentrating on performance. That wasn't the 13 pitch at all. So I think it is totally conceivable they could be doing that. But yes, it's frustrating that we don't actually know, because that's sort of their own internal business, and you don't get to know their internal business. We'll find out when they announce iOS 14, but, you know, here's hoping.
Well, we don't know except when we do. There was a Gurman article from late November, Inside Apple iPhone Software Shakeup After Buggy iOS 13 Debut. And this article talks about how apparently Federighi got everyone, all the troops in the same room, and basically said, hey, we're going to do a whole bunch of things totally different. And I don't remember the exact details. I haven't read this article since it came out. But the short of it is that they were planning on changing kind of the way they develop stuff leading up to release. And I had heard from a couple of different people that this article, while the details were wrong, surprise, surprise, but the general gist of it was accurate, that they are going to rework the way they do their work. And I don't know any more specifics than that, but that is indicative to me that there's at least some amount of acknowledgement and understanding that things are broken. Now, with that said, if it's anything like any of the places I've worked, the answer to a broken process is what, John?
More process.
Oh, yeah, more process. And so it very well could be that this is just going to make things worse and not better. But it's at least a small step in the right direction. And I think that we should acknowledge that, even though I do agree with everything both of you guys said.
I think that's what Marco was getting at, though. Like, when we hear stories like that, which obviously are not coming directly from Apple, so it's always, you know, game of telephone or whatever, that always sounds like the stuff you hear in any company when something bad goes wrong. They're always going to say, we're going to do things differently, or we're going to try harder or whatever. And I feel like because we're not privy to what's actually going on, rumors like that could go either way, because they're going to say that internally no matter what. And it could be they're just like, don't actually make any changes that effectively change things. But I feel like when they announce the OS, Apple knows by that point, have we pulled it off? Like when they were announcing iOS 12, it wasn't just like, oh, iOS 12 was going to be a stability release. They had been looking at iOS 12. They know, guess what? It's pretty, the number of bugs is low. We did what we set out to do. By the time they're announcing it to us, they know whether the thing they said 9 months earlier turned out to just be a bunch of BS, or whether it actually changed things for the better, whether their process changes actually, you know. So that's why I feel like, because we don't have a view of the internals, I think we just have to assume anything they say to themselves internally is meaningless and could go either way. But when they say it to us and we get the bits, you know, and when they say it, you know, honest, they're honest. When they say it to us, if they emphasize that it's stable and performant, it probably is, right? Because they already know. Like they you know, it's the WWDC build is a good way to judge things. Sometimes we always know the WWDC build is early, but if the WWDC build is actually kind of okay, that is a very good sign, right? And if it's not okay, it could still go either way, but it's not a good sign. So, you know, I'm waiting for June.
Like, I'm also not entirely sure that their alleged process changes from the article are going to be enough, even if they do it. I mean, because, you know, it did kind of sound like, we're going to fix this by working harder, which is not ever the solution to any real problem. But right now, iOS 13 is still full of tiny little paper cut bugs. And it's been like 5 months. If they make it so that the initial releases are better, what does that put them at? About where we are now? This still isn't good enough. And from what I'm guessing, from what I'm hearing, Catalina, which is only slightly younger, is not doing that much better. It's similar to the issue of what I said last week, that I honestly don't think Apple is capable of making great UIs anymore. It's almost seeming like they're not capable of shipping high-quality software anymore. And that's really scary, because if you look at what they've actually shipped, you know, over the last, I don't know, 5 years, there's not a lot of bright spots in quality. There's not a lot of releases you can point to and say that one was really good. Even iOS 12 had some issues. Like, it wasn't as bad as 13, but like, iOS 12 is pretty good, but I think that's been the best one. Like, even whatever the macOS version I'm running now was not great. Like, macOS seems to have even more issues than iOS a lot of times. But like, I don't know, I'm concerned. What they need to change are like fundamental priorities and resource allocations and process things. And I don't know that they've changed those. And I don't know that, I mean, a lot of that might even be above Craig Federighi's head. So we don't even know if he can change those. But regardless, like, it's unclear whether that level of change has happened. And anything less than that, if they're just saying we're going to work harder and we're going to, you know, feature flag disable bad stuff until we know it's ready, that isn't necessarily going to be enough.
Well, I'm glad at least I have a sort of canary for OS quality, kind of like the app modal preference dialog box in iTunes was a good canary for whether they've actually changed that app. Now I have the undead toolbars that keep popping up in my Finder window. I'll know that someone has finally paid attention to Mac OS when that bug gets fixed. I figure it will probably last another 3 or 4 releases before anyone even acknowledges its existence, and then 5 or 6 years it'll get fixed, because nobody cares about these bugs, because everyone just leaves the toolbar visible all the time, so why should anyone care? But yeah, it's good to have some way to measure, like, is my personal experience of macOS stability or iOS stability representative? Is there a systemic problem? Obviously, the part of that is you just look at the press and see what other people are complaining about or whatever. But paper cut bugs, like Marco was talking about, sometimes those last for a really long time because no one cares about that paper cut, or no one is staffed to work on that application at all. So it is not being changed at all. Or if it's being changed, this was a thing back in the early days of macOS that was an epidemic, and people on Apple used to complain about it. Like, you know, in 10.2 or 10.3 or whatever, you'd be responsible for the mail app finder. And the only thing you'd get to do in a release is you would be told that what you have to do is implement support for insert new headlining feature of macOS here, whether it's Spotlight or some new graphic system or make a dashboard widget or whatever. It's like, I wanted to do feature X with my application, or I wanted to refactor something or work on stability and performance. It's like, nope, you're doing Spotlight support, because that's the thing that we all, you know, there were so many major new features to the OS that it was important for Apple to be able to say, look, here's a major new technology or feature, and all our applications use it to great benefit to show you how good it is. And that would mean that with small teams, that's all they could do during the release. So they wouldn't have time to address just basic bugs with the boring functionality, because they would be worried about just making their app work with the new feature, integrating it in a good way, and making sure that their thing doesn't crash because now they're linking to some library that is being released for the very first time. That I don't think is happening anymore, but I can definitely see signs that applications that need some love and attention are getting very little of it, probably a fraction of some single person's time, just to make sure they still build and function more or less correctly in the new OS. But beyond that, not much. Hopefully, like, mail on iOS does not fall into that category. Hopefully, mail on iOS does not have a fraction of a single person's time working on it. But the Finder, I look at the Finder and I say, well, in this release, it's clear that they mostly worked on the thing where it replaces iTunes for your device management. And that must have been a super pain in the butt, filled with tons of old creaky code pulled out of iTunes. So I feel for that team. How toolbars are suddenly spawning, it's probably unrelated to that work, but I'm not surprised that they didn't have time to fix it and won't in the near future, because that the iTunes integration stuff is probably buggy and they probably have to fix that in the next release.
On the other side of the coin, though, you know, how quickly all three of us forget that they changed out the file system on, like, what, 2 billion devices, and I have not heard a single problem with any of them. Not to say that I'm the clearinghouse of it, but
that was a project that took, depending on how you measure, like a decade. So certain internal projects have slightly longer timelines. Nobody was saying, we need a new file system, we need it by this release. Or maybe they said that a couple of times, like when they pre-announced ZFS. But it's like, I don't know the political things that made that happen, but tech-wise, practically speaking, that was worked on for so long at a seemingly leisurely pace, which is the right thing to do for the file system. And that, you know, I'm glad they pulled it off. And with many sort of false starts of, like, what kind of file system do we want to have? What about one like this? What about one like that? I heard a story recently, I think it was some ex-Apple person, like, spilling some beans from long dead stuff. But, like, Spotlight, and I don't know if this is true, I don't even remember the source, because I see a lot of things on the internet, but the idea was that Spotlight, the search engine we know and love.
Well, at least the search engine we know.
Yeah. It began its life with one of the many, many efforts to figure out what to do about the file system, because, you know, HFS and HFS Plus have been creaky for a long time. And the idea was, like, let's just do sort of, instead of doing everything with file hierarchy, let's make a file system that does everything sort of just by indexing metadata, right? And just treat file path as another piece of metadata, which semantically is what every file system does, but, like, you know, let's do it, like, physically. Like, let's not privilege paths and anything else in the file system that have other metadata hanging off. Let's just make everything arbitrary metadata in this big sea of things. And you can view it as a file system if you view it in terms of that one piece of metadata, but it is not privileged over any other. And apparently that didn't work out. But by the time they'd done that enough to experiment with it, they said, well, this is not going to be our new file system because it doesn't fulfill that purpose very well, but it's a pretty good search engine, so can we reuse it for that? And that's what they did. They just made it a search and index system that lives on top of HFS Plus, but is not itself a replacement for the file system. So that's, according to the story anyway, one of their experiments about what to do about the file system that actually did ship, but not as a file system. So eventually we got APFS, but there were many other things, including ZFS, in between now and then. And that is a project and an effort that probably didn't have that many people on it, like a handful of engineers, but they worked on it for like 7 to 10 years and had many blind alleys and restarts or whatever. And obviously not every especially a project that's like for competitive purposes, like, oh, to be competitive, we need to have like a Face ID like feature. You can't spend 7 years in that because the world will pass you by. But for file systems, they dragged it out pretty much as long as they can, and they did pull it off. So props to them.
We are sponsored this week by Bluevine. Owning a small business is no easy task, and sometimes your cash flow just isn't moving at the speed of your business. Through Bluevine, you can secure a business line of credit in as little as 5 minutes. Bluevine is an easy, fast way to help support your business growth with a line of credit of up to $250,000. Whether you need money to offset upfront costs, secure inventory, or pay an unexpected expense, through Bluevine, you can help yourself and your business stay secure for any reason. There's no fee to set up your line of credit, and Bluevine never charges maintenance or prepayment fees. Applying is easy. Just go online to getbluevine.com/ATP. Fill out a few simple details, and you're done with your application within minutes. And seeing an offer will not affect your credit score. Once you get approved, funds can be received in as little as 24 hours. Have peace of mind knowing that funds can be drawn with the click of a button for any business expense. Bluevine has helped more than 20,000 customers and has delivered over $2.5 billion in funds to businesses. Bluevine also has advisors available by phone to answer any questions and help meet your business needs. With an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau and nearly 5-star reviews on Trustpilot, see why thousands of satisfied business owners have chosen Bluevine as their go-to source for financing. For listeners of the show, Bluevine is offering a special limited-time promotion of a $100 gift card when you take out a loan or open a line of credit with Bluevine. Go to getbluevine.com/ATP for more details. All you have to do is go to getbluevine.com/ATP and apply. That's quick, easy, and meaningful help to your business in as little as 24 hours. This promotional offer is subject to terms and conditions that can be found at getbluevine.com/ATP. Thank you so much to Bluevine for sponsoring our show.
Marco, are you using your iPad these days?
Every day.
For anything other than playing Overcast in the kitchen?
Well, I use it for like, you know, email and stuff like that sometimes, light web browsing, occasional, like, you know, Amazon ordering and stuff. But I don't know. It's funny. Like, literally just today, I was booking a trip where I just had to book, like, you know, a flight and a hotel, standard stuff. And I started doing it on my iPad to, like, look up flights and everything. And then I went to my computer to actually book it because I knew I'd have to be, like, juggling multiple tabs and pulling stuff out of 1Password and getting like my, you know, my TSA pre-number and stuff like that. Like, and I knew that would just be, I knew I could do it all on the iPad, but I also knew it would be a lot easier to just do it on my Mac. So I went to the office and did the whole thing here instead.
Don't blame you. Don't blame you at all. I don't know. I have such a, not love hate, because I like my iPad. So I have, and I presume you do as well. As we are recording this, the most recent iPad Pro, I have an 11-inch. So this is the first one with Face ID. And, you know, I was at Declan's swim lesson this afternoon, and I was trying to draft a blog post, and I was using the excellent Working Copy app, which is a Git client that's actually a pretty decent text editor, especially for Markdown. And I was able to, like, set the iPad wherever Michaela happened to be standing at that moment as she was running around playing with things and write a bit. And then if she ran somewhere else, it was so easy to just grab it, fold it up, and go somewhere else with it. And it was light, and I didn't even really have to think about it when I was carrying it. And in so many ways, I love it so much. But then I was trying to book our summer vacation just a few days ago, and I was doing a lot of like preliminary research on the iPad and realizing that it's just frustrating. Like, even though I have about the same amount of real estate as my MacBook Adorable, I just can't use it the way I want to, because the multitasking iPad, as I'm sure we'll discuss and Gruber has talked about a lot recently, is difficult to unintelligible, to incoherent, to incomprehensible, depending on where or what you're trying to do. And it's just, it ends up that all too often, if I'm doing anything even remotely serious, even something like just trying to plan a trip, I'm reaching for a computer. And oftentimes I'm going to my office and going to the 27-inch screen because that's the easiest one to get things done on. And so I completely echo what you've said.
What's a computer?
What is a computer even? It's a thing where you can actually get things done. That's what
it
is.
Oh, no. Oh, God. Please don't. Oh, God. All the emails. I can feel the emails from
please
here.
Please email Marco. So I don't know. It's just, it's tough because when my iPad does what I want it to do, it feels like the future, man, but all too often it feels like a future that hasn't quite arrived yet. So, John, I think of the three of us, you're probably the most consistent iPad fan and probably use yours the most. What are you on these days, and what are you doing with it?
I'm still just using a regular iPad Pro. I need to upgrade. I also have, this is a personal issue, but my eyes get worse, I'm constantly adjusting my glasses prescription because I'm having more trouble seeing close up. And so at a certain point, you go to bifocals, and my eye doctor keeps telling me I'm not quite there yet for bifocals. But it is still, with my glasses on, especially when my eyes are tired, it gets harder and harder for me to focus on something held in my hand close to my face, right? So when I use my iPad now, there's like a distance. Like I can't bring it. I don't have to hold it at arm's length, but I used to apparently hold it much closer to myself than I do now. So now I have to put it back like 1 or 2 inches to be able to focus on it when my eyes are tired at night. And that is actually cutting into my iPad time. A lot of times what I will switch to instead is using my phone super close to my face with my glasses off, just as a more comfortable thing to do at night when my eyes are tired. So, but that's nothing to do with the iPad. That's just me personally. All that is to say that I'm using my iPad slightly less than I used to be. But I do use it, and I do what Marco described is absolutely true of my experience as well, in that when I want to do anything complicated, I want to do it on the Mac. And complicated means I'm going to be juggling multiple things. I'm going to be like, a good example is a thing that I often start on my iPad and then switch to the Mac is, like, if I'm looking for something, to give an example, all the crap I bought when I was preparing the way for my Mac Pro, the things like the little end table and, you know, cables and cable guides and the UPS and, you know, power plugs that go into them and adapters and pigtail things and just, you know, all that stuff. A lot of that I started out, I'd be like in bed on my iPad and I'd be like, let's look at this. Let's look and see, you know, I'd do a search for UPS things and watch some reviews and especially like watch some YouTube videos or reviews. But at a certain point I say, okay, now I'm in serious research mode. I'm going to open 500 tabs about UPSs, right? Or I'm going to open every furniture site in the entire world, every store, Target, Walmart, Wayfair, Ethan Allen, Crate and Barrel. Like, they're all going to be open in 100 windows and 100 tabs, and I'm going to be taking screenshots and copying images into a notes document and saving URLs and typing down measurements. It's time for the Mac, because I could do that on the iPad, but I would drive myself insane with the text selection alone, right? So I will go to, and I think that's not a condemnation of the iPad, because the whole point of the Mac is it's supposed to give you more space, more flexibility, more precise input than a thing that you can carry around with you. Like it's a desktop, I'm using anyway, desktop computer, and my screens are huge. Now, to Casey's point, that's not always true. There are Macs that have smaller screens, and they also have a lot of these benefits, but anyway, I do feel that tension in, like, at a certain point, like, let me just go to the Mac. And a lot of that is also because the Mac is what I grew up with. It's what I'm most comfortable with. And when I was reading Gruber's thing where he was sort of slamming the iPad's crappy multitasking and how undiscoverable and awkward it is, I mostly agree with him. But there is an angle on that, which is like, well, if you grew up using this, it wouldn't be so weird to you, right? It's not quite the same as the... God, I've forgotten the name of the thing. What the hell is the app that had intentionally obscure UI? Snapchat. To make people, you know, it's not quite Snapchat, but it's similar in that if you grew up, you know, anything you grew up using, A, seems, you know, seems natural to you because it's all you know, and B, there is a certain kind of cachet to, like, you're young, you have a lot of time to invest in learning a weird thing, and once you know it, it's part of your, you know, personality and self-image that, of course, you know how to use this thing, and anyone who doesn't is a square, using a term from the 50s. reading Gruber's thing, you can look at it and say, you know, well, Grandpa, you may feel comfortable with the Mac, but if you grew up using the iPad, or if you adopted it in early enough in your life, it is totally natural, and none of this stuff is weird, and you learn it once, and it's no big deal, and you just sound like an old fuddy-duddy, right? But I think that the angle is there, and there is a tiny bit of truth to that, but there is much more truth to the idea that, like, look, there's ways you can measure how good a UI is. And Gruber touches on a lot of them in the article that we'll put in the show notes. One of the ways is just across the entire customer base for this product, all the people who own it. How many people use this feature? How many people know that it exists? How many people enjoy it? How many people find it indispensable and useful to use, right? How many, and on the other side, how many people, if you describe the problem that this feature is supposed to solve, would say, oh, I have that problem too. And then when you say to them, oh, well, then why don't you use feature X to solve that problem? They'll be like, I didn't know how to use feature X. I didn't know it existed. And once you tell me, it's too awkward to use. Like, there are ways to measure the success of any feature. And that way is not, find the person who is the most expert in using this product and see if they like it. Like, you can actually look at the customer, you know, how many people, and this is true of weird features in the Mac too, but you can say, like, how many people who own the Mac use the dock? I think it is widely used. I think it's very widely used. Whatever problem the dock is solving is a problem that people have because they use the dock, and I think most people use it, right? Or how many people ever have more than one window open on their Mac? I think that number is also high. People discover how to open a second window because it solves a problem that they have, that they want to see more than one thing at the same time, and they're able to successfully do that with a Mac. It is a thing that happens all the time. On the iPad, very similar fundamental things, like how many people have more than one thing open on the iPad at once? It's a fraction of the people who do it on the Mac. How many people know how to do it on the iPad? Also a fraction of the people on the Mac. How many people know but still don't do it, right? Those things, I think, are mostly, you know, uncontested. It doesn't mean the iPad is necessarily bad, but in a weird way, it frames the iPad as most useful to deep experts. And then there's a big gulf, and then useful to people who only need simple functionality. And it's that gulf that the iPad needs to span. I was thinking about this. I had what I thought was a coherent thought, and I put a note to myself in the show notes. And then I looked at my note, and I realized either my thought was not as coherent as I thought it was, or I forgot what I thought.
This happens to me all the time.
They're trying to write down a dream.
Yeah, exactly. But it was basically this. Like, the guru wrote this thing about how the multitasking on the iPad is weird and all this stuff. And it's like, the iPad, the things that are great about the iPad, and we talked about this many times, and the reason people are enthusiastic about it, and the reason I'm still enthusiastic about it, is that it provides, it gets rid of a lot of crap from the world of PCs that you don't have to deal with anymore. Some would call it a simplification, but I think it's mostly just dropping stuff that only exists for weird historical reasons. So, like smartphones, the iPad is more comfortable for people to use. They're not worried that they're going to screw it up or that they don't know how to get stuff done. It's generally tractable and low maintenance. That is the big thing that makes people keep saying, why do people keep saying the iPad is the future of computing, and why do people like phones instead of their PCs? Like, writ large, the answer is they're less of a pain in the butt to deal with, right? And that is the greatest feature of all these things. And that's why it's so weird that where the iPad falls down, like in terms of like, oh, let's try to also make it possible to do more powerful things. It falls down in like just stepping out of that and expanding its power by including a multitasking system that's the opposite of that. It's more weird and complicated than the PC. It brings more obscure rules and strange, physically difficult gestures. And, you know, like, it doesn't make as much sense, and it is more obscure. It's like, you know, it's not like they took, the problem is not that they said, okay, well, let's, we want to make the iPad more powerful, so let's give it some of the power of the Mac, but in a simplified form. Like, maybe they thought they were doing that, but what they ended up doing was giving it the power of the Mac in a more complicated form that's harder to use. And it's so weird because you don't need, like, I think what I was trying to get is like, this is not a problem that the iPad had, like, that. The problem was that, you know, we need to come up with a whole new way of working with multiple things that is simpler. Or maybe that was a problem that happened, but they didn't do it. They came up with a whole new way of working with multiple things that's harder and more obscure and more complicated and more difficult to use. And bottom line, less used. Less, like, it is less successful as a feature because fewer people actually use it. So are you really helping people if they say, oh, well, I don't do that because it's just too weird and too complicated? And again, you can't look at the outliers and say, look at how this maestro of the iPad is able to get tons of work done. That's good that it's able to do that, but part of the reason it's so impressive is, you know, what is it, like a bear riding the unicycle? It's like impressive that they can do it at all because it's generally acknowledged to be difficult and complicated. And that's not how it should be. No one sees someone on the Mac with two windows open and goes, wow, you must be a Mac expert. But you see someone with three things in split screen and an iPad and a slide over, and you assume they're an iPad expert. And that is probably the biggest condemnation of the iPad's advancement. And Gruber is pretty harsh in the article saying, look, they need to just start over, like clean slate. And it's not unprecedented. It's been done plenty of times before. Like, rethink this. Whatever paradigm you thought you were going for is not resonating and not working. Come up with some sort of new consistent paradigm, or if you can't do that, you know, use the old paradigm of a bunch of windows that you can move around, which I don't think anyone is asking for, because like that's the nightmare of any iPad enthusiast. But like the current system is not succeeding. It is failing in all the same ways that the whole rest of the iPad succeeds. Like it's too complicated and too obscure. So, you know, I'm not demanding that Apple, you know, wipe the slate clean, but I also don't quite know how they can salvage what they have without at least one or two fundamental adjustments to how they think about doing more complicated things on the iPad, because it's got the CPU power. A lot of them have the screen space now, and the input methods are there as well. You've got the pencil and the finger and, you know, all these different sensors and everything. It's the software that's falling down. It's the software that's not, and it's not, you know, it's not bugs or whatever. It is software design, you know, the
but there's bugs too.
Well, I suppose, but the iPad...
Try using keyboard shortcuts in Mail.
Yeah, yeah. The iPad has evolved to this point through a series of small steps, none of which really seem like they ever had the big think, right? Of like, you know, some did the big, you know, Xerox, essentially, and Xerox and the Mac team did various big thinks of like, what does it mean to have a graphical user interface? How does it work? What are the building blocks? And then... riffed on those and built on that fairly solid foundation of, you know, the WIMP Windows, what was it, Windows icons, menus, and pointer.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very solid, it continues to be a very solid, flexible foundation. If there had been no foundation, but it had just been like, well, we got kind of a GUI, but we have some kind of graphical interface, let's add this feature, let's add that feature, let's let people have more than one thing, let's do this thing. Like, if you grow it piecemeal like that and never have sort of a solid, extensible underlying philosophy, you will end up in something that's a complicated mess. So that's, I think, what they need to do with the iPad is step back and rethink. They did that for the iPhone. Let's rethink. Oh, the application takes over the whole screen. It's edge to edge, blah, blah. They came up with a paradigm for phone applications and for simple iPad applications that totally works and people love and use. It's the next step where they're falling down, where what about when you want to do something more complicated than you could do on a phone because we have this big, powerful iPad. How do we deal with that? I think the answer is not what they've currently done. I think, you know, they need to regroup. And I'm not saying they need to totally redesign iOS the next thing after we got through. We're saying they're supposed to do refinement releases and fix stability, but this is a design thing that I totally give them a few years to work on. I just hope their plan is not, we'll continue to refine what we have, because I just don't think it's working.
The biggest characterization of the iPad that I've felt and that I think, and I think you actually just basically agreed with implicitly, is like, if you think about, and I should blog this, but I'm not going to, so, because I don't want the response. So if you think about like a graph, you know, standard XY two-dimensional graph, on one axis you have the complexity of what you're trying to do, and on the other axis you have how easy it is to do. I think for most, you know, standard computer, you know, Mac PC kind of things, that line is kind of a gentle slope. Like the complexity of what you want to do versus how easy it is to do it kind of ramps smoothly for most things. Yeah, there are some bumps along the way. That being said, where that starts, like the zero point of that graph, is high. Like there's a certain baseline of knowledge required to use a computer at all and do tasks at all, and there's a certain baseline level of complexity you have to deal with, even for easy things. However, as you scale up, you know, that line climbs, but there's not a lot of like huge spikes in it. Whereas iPad usage, the ease of use of easy things is way lower. That line starts way lower. However, as you progress towards trying to do more complicated things, it just shoots way up. Easy stuff is easier, but hard stuff is way harder. And what is even considered a hard thing on iOS is oftentimes like not a very hard or uncommon thing in the PC Mac world. I don't think iPads or phones for that matter, but you know, I think it's more of a problem on the iPad. I don't think they have ever really found a good way around this. That the whole reason the iPad is easier to use for simple things are fundamental aspects of its design. Things like that all apps at least start out full screen, and that all apps only have, at least normally, one window, and that all apps, you know, you tap the icon and that just shows, and then you hit the home button if you still have one, and then, you know, then you see all your apps and you hit the next one, and they take away the concept of files. And that's all great when you're doing really simple things. But as soon as you have to do something that's slightly outside of that, like, golden path of easiness, the barrier of complexity and difficulty goes way up. Like, as John was saying, like, you really have to be an iPad expert to do a lot of things that on a computer are considered pretty trivial things. You know, stuff like, you know, like shuffling files in different places between apps and you know, and dealing with multiple windows. Like, I still can't, for the life of me, drag a tab to the right side of Safari without accidentally opening a new window. And then God knows how to close it. I have never figured this out. I eventually have to, like, you know, start, like, kicking stuff out of the force quit thing. And eventually I never can recover that tab. Like, I just got to start a new one. Like, that tab's gone. Like,
it's not just expertise. Like, that's the important point of, like, when I'm saying you can actually measure this. It's not just, you know, it's like, well, if you have to be an expert to know all these secrets. It's not knowing. It's like physical capabilities. Like, how hard is it physically to do this? Part of the, you know, the beauty of the Mac user, and again, Gruber touched on this with double clicking, is you can say, like, this is how a feature works. Can people do it? Is it actually physically hard? And I'm not talking about people who are, you know, have disabilities. Like, it's just all of us, everybody. Like, everyone is disabled to some degree. It's just a question of, you know, what that degree is. There is no discontinuity. It's just a smooth spectrum from supposedly able to supposedly disabled. Like, right? It's difficult to precisely control things as you drag. Like, you have to hold pressure on the screen, because if you pick your finger up on the iPad or any touch device, it cancels the drag. And you know the edges are hot, like a game of Operation, right? If you accidentally go to the edge, something different's going to happen. I had the big rant a couple, you know, many shows ago about trying to rearrange icons on Springboard on the phone. And, you know, to add to that, like, if you're going to pick up multiple items and do all those multi-finger things, it is actually physically difficult to do those, even if you are a quote-unquote expert and know exactly what you're supposed to be doing. And that's the sign of a feature that you could, that is measurably bad for most users. Even very dexterous, very careful ones, it's frustrating because you don't know where the live hot areas are. There's no visual indication. Even if you have incredibly precise motor control and you're in a situation where you can do that because the iPad is well-supported and you're not on the go, like, that's not hard because it's an expert feature. That's hard because it's a bad feature. It is hard for human beings to use. And fundamentally, because it is a thing that you carry, and because there's no pointing device, and because, you know, whatever, like, there are some, you know, that's the problem they have to solve. But there are other parts of it that they've chosen to do themselves. The fact that there is no Chrome in any of the windows. Again, a simplification, but it also means there is no affordances visually and touch-wise in the UI for you to have a safe area to grab or move things to or anything like that. And so that's the challenge they face, and I feel like their solutions to it are measurably not as successful as they should be, just because they're so hard that lots of people can't do it. Like, Marco, you know what you're trying to do with that stupid tab, mm-hmm. but you just physically can't. It's like a video game that's hard to play, and that's not a good UI.
Yeah, it's like, I just have a very high error rate for this common task. Like,
yeah.
And I think a lot of that, by the way, we're hearing from a few people in the chat, that apparently you can long press on the tabs icon, and there's a merge all windows button to solve my tabs
loading problem. That's the undiscoverability, because there's no Chrome or menu bar or anything like that.
I would never have found that. I had no chance of ever knowing that. So, yeah. And I think this is part of the thing. Like, what makes it so simple to do the simple tasks is a large degree of both physical and of, like, design, like, you know, both hardware and software simplicity visually, that everything, like, yeah, you know, you everything app is full screen, and you said there's no window Chrome and everything, and then that's great. It keeps simple things simple. But then where do you put the advanced stuff? You start doing things like overriding what edges mean, and you start hiding things behind long press. And one of the greatest challenges of UI design for touch devices since the beginning is, how do you make things discoverable that aren't immediately visually on the screen? Like, if you're not going to just have an icon or a button on screen that can do something, how do you show people that they can do it? That is a largely unsolved design problem among among touch devices. Like we, you know, we have a few bad solutions. We have like the, you know, first launch overlay or arrow saying, "Ooh, click here to see all these options." Those are terrible. We have the junk drawer design. First it was the hamburger menu, then it was the action menu, now it's the dot 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 menu. They're all the same thing. It's all just like more. Shove a whole bunch of stuff into the more button and people will push it to find more. You know, like that's all these solutions are, you know, mediocre at best. They just don't have the kind of discoverability that you have in a typical PC interface where you typically have way more real estate on screen and you have, you know, smaller buttons because they're, you know, you're controlling it with a more precise pointing device. So usually you have like a, you know, you can fit more buttons or icons in a toolbar, then you have the whole menu system and you can pull down the series of menus and see what things are, or you can right click on things to see what you can do.
Right click is a great example because that is an example of a thing with no visual affordance that seems to be totally undiscoverable, but because it is so unfailingly consistent in the PC Mac interface, it becomes culturally successful. Like there's no visual indication that you can right click on things. But again, look out into the world. How many people who use a personal computer of any kind know that right clicking exists? Now, it is less than 100%, but the percentage is way higher than the people like who right click stuff on their PC. It's way higher than the number of people who use split screen and multitasking, sophisticated multitasking on the iPad, because it is one additional thing to learn, which is, you know, one thing that you wouldn't have to learn for simple things, but it is just, it's everywhere. If you see something and you don't see a visual way to interact with it, one of the things you can try, and usually your first instinct is, let me try right-clicking it, because people have been trained through very consistent use of that, that even though there is no indication this is going to be successful, it's a good first guess. Can I right-click it? Is there some menu to right, can I right-click on this and then there's a menu that says delete? Can I right-click it to get info about it? And right-clicking is incredibly successful, so successful that Apple, which insisted on single-button mice for a long time, had to come around to basically enable right-click, you know, by control-click in the beginning and then eventually by making a single-button mouse that lets you do right-clicking. There are solutions to these problems. They're tricky. And getting back to the double-clicking thing that Gruber pointed out, just to clarify what we're talking about if you don't bother to read the article, double-clicking on the Mac is a tricky situation where they added this thing, which is like, well, single click to select and double click to open, right? And it's a very simple, very consistent paradigm on the Mac. But it has the problem that double clicking is a physically tricky thing to do. Not that tricky. You're like, double clicking, it's not like I'm doing a multi-finger, five-finger drag on the iPad, right? Double clicking, how hard is it to double click, right? It is actually physically difficult because what determines if something is a double click is the space between the clicks. And that's why, since the beginning, the Mac has had a feature where you can adjust the tolerance for what the OS, you know, considers a double click. There's a setting, I believe, to this day in system preferences and on the original Macintosh that says, should I give you lots of time if you go click, click, click? Is that a double click? Or do you have to go click, 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 right? Because it is difficult for people to do that. In particular, I saw this early on with the Mac when mice were new. It's difficult for people to double click without accidentally moving the mouse between the two clicks, which makes it kind of not count as much as a double click, depending on the heuristics of the operating system, right? That is, you know, compared to multi-finger drag, that's nothing, but that is an epidemic problem that has never really gotten better. Some people still have trouble with double click. And the second thing is, unlike culturally with right click, where everybody knows, I can't figure out how to use this thing, let me try right-clicking it, which is generally a safe thing to do. It's not going to do anything harmful, like culturally it's understood or whatever. Single-click versus double-click, despite being, I think, a very clear, easily explained paradigm from day one on graphical user interfaces, still is a source of confusion for people. You see people double-click links in web browsers. You see people double-click literally everything, because it's basically like, I clicked it and it didn't work, so maybe I should double click it. And then people very often short circuit that to say, if I see anything on the screen and I really want it to work, I should double click it instead of single click it. And in general, that will work. Like, if it requires a single click and you double click, most of the time it will do the thing. So maybe that's why people are trained to do it. But even that one minor complexity through decades of use, like, human nature is such that single click versus double click, if you had to go back and say, what is the paradigm that you might want to rethink about the WIMP, you know, graphical user interface? Single click versus double click turns out to be surprisingly tricky for people to master. And if they haven't done it by now, they probably never will. So it's always going to be slightly less successful than you'd want it to be. Versus right click, which wasn't thought of back then, even though the Xerox mouse had like five buttons on it or three buttons or whatever and was even more complicated. Right click, I think, has been much more successful. So I do have some hope that there are solutions that don't require visual affordances that can be culturally successful and physically easy to do. You know, you could argue, oh, that's long press or that's forced press. Or like, you know, Apple has tried a whole bunch of things in that area, but none of them have been consistent or popular enough to get by. I think like maybe long press is getting there. People do kind of understand that you can long press things in touch interfaces and you might get, you know, options or whatever. But anyway,
do they? Like,
I think more than people know how to do split screen on the iPad, that's for sure. Like, I've seen people in my family do long press on things, but I've never seen anyone in my family do split screen on an iPad. So
I'm not even sure how I'm supposed to be doing split screen. Every time I try to do it, I occasionally will use it, and every time I try to do it, it takes me a very long time to figure out the exact combination of where I press and hold, where I drag it, where I let it go. Do I like stick it down or stick it up or stick it? Like, it takes me a very long time. And I officially know it. Like, I ostensibly know how to do this. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's a lot of waiting. There's a lot of like, oh, I accidentally didn't, you know, stick this down in the right spot, so it wiggles back to somewhere else. And like, I'm good at computers. I do this for a living. I use an iPad every day, and I have multitasked on every version of iOS that has supported multitasking. And I'm still bad at doing it on the iPad because, I mean, I guess I don't do it enough, but I think the bigger problem is it's just so fiddly. And a lot of this is down to, you know, factors like we're saying about, you know, undiscoverability of touch gestures. And a lot of it is down to because there are basically no buttons in the hardware, and because the software UI paradigm is to make everything full screen and to not have things like window Chrome or menus, that inherently makes it really hard to design these things in a way that is intuitive and discoverable. Like, it'd be one thing if Apple redesigned iPadOS so that every app by default had a title bar that had some buttons in the corner that would do things like maximize it to the full screen or shrink it to half screen.
That would have to be big Chrome. Like, that's the reason they're resisting, is because your pointing device is so imprecise that it would have to be comically large, and now you're eating into your limited screen space. Like, I understand why they don't, but
yeah, but they just made all the screens bigger.
Yeah, I know.
If they really want to make multitasking on the iPad intuitive and something that everyone is able to do reliably and able to figure out, they have to put it on screen. They have to have on-screen controls for multitasking to be really easy. And that just goes completely against the software design paradigm of iPadOS. And that may make certain things worse. That might make that floor of how simple things can be, it might raise it very slightly.
Because you could accidentally hit the window controls when you didn't mean to, and then you're like, oh, where'd my window go?
Right. But I would argue that's actually better overall than where we are now, which is you have these kind of secret gestures that come up when you move near edges or do weird things that it would be not at all surprising to me if the vast majority of invocations for iPad multitasking were accidental.
Yeah, everything is hot on your screen. Like, this is,
yes,
this is like
which raises that floor.
Yeah, I use slide over a lot. Surprisingly, I more or less know how it works, and I like the thing where you can switch between the slide over stuff. You know, I've worked that into my workflow, and it mostly is okay. But because the floor is lava, because everything is hot,
yes,
in iPad OS, when I'm watching, for example, Netflix, and like sometimes I'll be watching Netflix, and I'll bring over Twitter to just look at something because I'm watching something cruddy or whatever. Like, I'm multitasking on my iPad. Look at me go. Sometimes when I bring over slide over, that gesture gets registered by the underlying like Netflix or Hulu player, and like the slide over comes on, but the video I'm watching goes back 30 seconds because that app has a gesture for a swipe backwards. And depending on the speed that you do it, like, because you can, to slide over, you have to start in a certain position and bring it over. But if you go a little bit too fast, the underlying app registers it a gesture. Arguably, that's a bug in the app below it, but you can't blame the app author. They're like, look, if someone swipes their finger from right to left, I should go back 30 seconds. And as far as they're concerned, that's exactly what's happened. But as far as the OS is concerned, they're like, oh, no, they were activating slide over. But both of the things get it. Like, there is no safe area. And I think the experts, you know, talking about, like, doing split screen and multitasking and dragging things, the experts learn mentally the map of the safe hot regions and like how long you have to hover and how long you have to press and when it's safe to move and what areas you should avoid. Like, that's part of the expertise, is learning this invisible heat map and this invisible, like, four-dimensional timing map of, like, it's not intellectually doing, but, you know, through repetition. Like, I know I've gotten better about putting things into slide over and going into multitasking just by sort of learning the routes and everything. And that can have a feeling of like mastering a video game and being good at it, and can give like positive feelings towards the experience, because like I invested time into this and now I'm good at it. Now I feel like a real maestro. But again, that's not a characteristic of a good user interface. It shouldn't be. It's fun to master a game. It's not fun to have to master something that just, you know, you're just trying to shop around for, you know, new UPS for your fancy computer, whatever it is you're doing. You want more people to be successful. You don't want the people who master it to feel an incredible amount of satisfaction, right? You want everyone to feel that satisfaction, because everybody is able to successfully have more than one window on the screen or whatever.
So to that end, this is my favorite thing in the world. And by favorite, I mean least favorite thing in the world. So let's suppose that you have your iPad Pro or iPad or whatever, and you have your smart keyboard attached and open and so on and so forth. And let's suppose you're looking at Safari full screen, right? And you want to get a second app in split view. The most direct way to do this, at least on the iPad Pro that I have, is you swipe up just a little bit from the bottom, because if you swipe up too much, you're going to go home. You don't want to go home. You just want to swipe up a little bit. You swipe up a little bit and you grab one of the things in your dock, and then you just drag that icon over to the side, and suddenly you have split view. Split view, right? I don't even know the damn terminology for this stuff. Anyway, so that's all well and good, but what if you don't have what you want in your dock? So let's suppose that I don't have Notes in my dock, even though I actually do. But let's suppose Notes is on one of my home screens, and I'm looking at Safari full screen, and I want to get Notes off to the side. Well, I can't go to the dock because it's not there. So when I have the keyboard attached, it's actually slightly straightforward. I just Command Space and type in Notes, and then I get the Notes icon, and I drag it from the spotlight window over to the side, and now all's well. So far, so good. How do I do that if I can't hit Command Space? I have an answer to this question, but can you guys tell me how you do this?
I read an answer earlier, so I'm spoiled, but it's ridiculous.
Right. So what I've figured out, and maybe this isn't the best way, but what I've figured out is you start by going home. So I'm now looking at my home screen. I find Notes on the home screen. I pick up the Notes icon and I drag it, which of course is starting to make me rearrange the home screen.
Right. Or delete Notes.
or delete Notes. Then I swipe up from the bottom with a different hand, just a bit, not too much now, just a bit. Now I've got multitasking up. I'm still holding with the other hand. I select Safari for multitasking. Now the icon becomes a window and I drag the window off to the side. Once I've done this 10 times, it vaguely, I wouldn't even say it makes sense, but it's a repeatable series of actions. Let's put it that way. But how preposterous is this? Like, how does any human being figure this out without being instructed directly? How do you figure this out?
And even if you're instructed, can you imagine teaching someone to do that? Oh, don't go too far. Oh, wait, no, hold that, but don't hold it. Like, there's so many hot regions that if you hold it over this for too long, it does this thing, but you want to not let it go. And remember, don't take your finger off the glass, but pull up just a little bit, but go to the left. And now they use the second finger to do this. And that, like,
right.
It's like trying to teach someone to dance, but it's like, this is what most people will say is, it's already too complicated. I'll just do it the other way. Like, it's not, they give up on trying to have two applications there at the same time. Like, I know how to switch between them the old-fashioned way. I'll just do that, even though it's slightly less convenient. No, you know, it's not worth it to go over that hurdle. And that's not a successful feature. If what you're trying to do is enable people to use two apps at once and they're bailing on it because it's too weird, rethink.
Yeah, my other favorite part of this is, so let's assume I'm trying to do this all over again. So I was in Safari, I go home, I'm looking at my home screen. I pick up the Notes icon, I'm moving it around, and then I see, oh, Safari is also on the screen, perhaps on the dock, perhaps just on the home screen. I want to bring that back. So what do? I tap the Safari icon. Oh, shit, I'm now collecting two icons. That's not what I wanted at all. Like, it's just it's like you said, the floor is lava.
But it's so easy to drop that second icon, Casey. You know how to do that, don't you?
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Exactly.
Where's a safe place to drop it?
Yeah, it beats me. It's just, it's so frustrating because it could be so good. It could be so, so good. And when I do get that moment, and it happens, and it doesn't happen infrequently, when I get that moment, a great example of this is I've taken a screenshot of something and I want to mark it up. Well, on the Mac, that's kind of a pain in the hindquarters. Yep. You know, I have to figure out some way of doing this on the Mac. On the iPad, I grab the pointing device connected to the iPad. That's amazing. That is so much better than anything I would have to do on the Mac. And it works so much more nicely. But so much of using the iPad is an exercise in frustration. And I don't really want to open this can of worms, but here I go. If I need to write a series of shortcuts in order to do the things that I can do so much easier on the Mac, then I'm just going to do them on the Mac. And yes, I understand that there are human beings that prefer iOS. I get that. I really, truly do. But for me, even if I don't have a particular preference between macOS and iOS, I can tell you that because I'm fluent in both, it is so much faster for me and easier for me to do stuff on the Mac that all too often, that's what I'm choosing. And it's so frustrating because the physical hardware of the iPad Pro, especially with Face ID, it's beautiful, it's light, it's powerful, it's fast.
Cellular.
It's cellular. It's so much what I want. It's so much what I want. But the software just falls on its face, and it makes me so sad.
And I would even say there are lots of things that the software is better at too. Like it isn't that iPadOS is just bad and macOS is good. Like there's a lot of differences in the OSs and especially in the apps on those OSs. There's no clear way I can't just say like everything on macOS is better or everything on iOS is better. But it just seems like there is so much about iPad multitasking and my iPad UI use that relies on modes or timing, or hidden gestures. And those, ask anybody who's ever tried to design computer interfaces, modes, timing tricks, and hidden gestures are recipes for total disasters of usability. And what makes the iPad great, and especially what made it great initially, is none of that. What makes it great is the opposite. It's the simplicity. It's that when you're on that golden simple path of doing like, you know, everything full screen and, you know, just doing simple things where you never have to deal with files or multitasking or anything, when you're just doing that, you don't have any of those problems and it's glorious. But as you try to do more stuff on your iPad, you slam into those walls pretty quickly, and to get over those walls is so cumbersome. And it's all because you have this device that Apple really wants to keep simple, you know, without losing what's good about that low barrier to entry for it. And I think the only solution to this is to put goddamn controls on the screen. Like, put them in the UI. You have buttons that you can push to do things. That's how you solve this. And it's not always going to look pretty, and it's not always going to be conceptually design purity maximum. But design purity maximum is how you get pretty things, not usable things. And it is possible to have both. You know, if you have a nicely designed UI, it has its own form of beauty. Like, nice, easy-to-use UI is itself beautiful. It's a different version of beauty than clean, minimalism, Johnny White Room, you know, junk drawer design, like what they do now. It's a different style. But it's not worse. It's not ugly. It's just different. And I don't see how you add the complexity that power users want to the iPad, or that all users want, honestly, or at least many of them. I don't know how you add that complexity and power to iOS without sacrificing some of that visual purity. Having a title bar with windows like on the screen, even if you can't freeform shape those windows, even if you don't like drag the corner to resize it, which there's different choices you can make there, but like, if there was just like a basic amount of window chrome, think of the functionality you get out of window chrome on the Mac. You know, not only do you have sizing controls, you also have hiding and showing that window, and you have closing that window for good, like getting rid of it, minimizing it, you know, big, small. Then you also have the title bar, which tells you what app you're in or what thing you are viewing. Then you have the proxy icon, which is a shortcut to tons of power. And then, of course, you know, if it's if it's visually combined, you have the whole toolbar, which itself is a massive amount of potential power. Buttons, and you have navigation back forward. You might have a search box. Like, there's so much that is in standard window Chrome. And that's not even, again, not even including, like, if you want to drag the corners to resize it, because, we'll, you know, that may or may not be a good idea in iPad OS. Who knows? But if you just had a small amount of window Chrome on every window for an app, for apps that supported this, that would expose a ton of basic multitasking functionality in a really easy way that wouldn't require all these weird gestures that are too easy to do accidentally and too hard to do intentionally. There's a reason why people do this. It's like when I made the magazine and I tried to make no setting screen, and I had such incredible complexity because I didn't want a setting screen, and that the result ended up being worse and harder to use, and then I had to eventually just put a damn setting screen in it because that was actually better. I feel like, think about all of the hoops Apple has jumped through and made its users jump through to avoid having like basic window controls on iPad OS. Is it really worth it?
They're trying to preserve the simplicity. Like, that seems to be their job one, which you can kind of understand because the simplicity is the big selling point, but they haven't found, like, the solutions we're always going to, I think, you know, many, many shows ago when we discussed this, we were just talking about having menu bars on iPad apps. Do you remember that discussion?
Mm-hmm.
We keep going to solutions that we know work in the Mac world because it's like, at a certain point, and we've had this discussion over many years, at a certain point, it's like, look, you didn't come up with something better. You haven't, like, it's, we're not saying you got to do everything the same way the Mac did it. Come up with a new way. Show us. You tried a bunch of ways and they all suck. And so we get back to this point where it's like, well, how about just window Chrome? Like, because you haven't come up with something better. I'm not saying window Chrome is a solution. And in fact, when you're discussing window Chrome, it made me think about some of the regressions they've had on the Mac. As you know, if you're staring at a Mac right now, there isn't window Chrome to speak of. And I have seen many people have difficulty resizing Mac windows because to do it, there is a very small region of pixels near the edge of a window where you will get the appropriate arrow cursor. And there's different arrow cursors because Mac windows are resizable from all sides, which power users love. But regular users might not understand that if you reach for the corner and you end up grabbing a side and you get the little arrow, you can only resize in one direction now. And that's frustrating. And in general, just getting to the point where you get the appropriate resize cursor, because there's no visual affordance for it. And because the windows are basically borderless, which looks very clean, there is a very small region where you have to do that compared to, you know, Mac OS, you know, the old Mac OS with the Platinum interface that had a big textured square with little grippy things, which wasn't a huge target, but it was absolutely visual and it was big enough where you could get it. And, you know, when windows weren't resizable from the edges, you didn't have that problem. So even in systems that are tried and true, it's possible to, through visual refinement, end up making interfaces harder to use. Even if people aren't confused about how to resize windows, I think resizing Mac windows is now harder than it used to be for that reason. And the purity argument of like, oh, the interface isn't as pure, I think I keep calling it WIMP. I hate that acronym, but anyway, it's my, you know, the Mac user interface, I know it's not just the Mac, but anyway, has incredible purity. Menu bar at the top of the screen, windows with scroll bars that are resizable with closed widgets and, you know, with window widgets, like, and even the dock, like, that there is incredible purity to that paradigm and incredible flexibility. It has stood the test of time. You're able to do amazing things with it. It is more pure than the iPad OS interface, which has many different paradigms all fighting with each other and various things tacked on to the end, and none of them are sort of composable and flexible enough to get the job done on their own. All so they can preserve the simple interface, which I'm all for preserving the simplicity. It's just that you need to find a way to enable more sophisticated actions without killing that simplicity, but also by making a consistent system, and they haven't done it yet. And so we say, well, have you tried just sticking a menu bar? Think of how much flexibility putting just a plain old menu bar at the top of the screen on an iPad would do. You'd have to make it like a finger-capable menu bar or whatever. But we said, oh, that's old thinking. You just want it to be the way the Mac is. I don't, actually. I want something better. But if you can't think of something better, I'll take the compromise of, we couldn't come up with any better ideas, so here is a finger-accessible menu bar, right? We couldn't come up with any ideas, so here is some kind of window Chrome in iPad OS, which necessarily has to be larger and, you know, and hurts the complexity, hurts the simplicity or whatever. But you do, that's the challenge. That's the challenge Apple faces. Come up with something that preserves the best of both, but provides the power and is consistent. And they have not risen to that challenge. And honestly, I don't think we have risen to that challenge either, because everything we're suggesting, I think, would be mostly an abomination and terrible. But on the high end, it would make the complicated things that we're describing easier and better to do. It's just that on the low end, they would make people, you know, confused and frustrated. And I think in general, the public would think an iPad that works that way is worse than an iPad that works the way it does now. Because one of the, you know, I was saying how we never see people using multitasking the iPad. Also, for all the iPad users that I am intimately familiar in my life who aren't tech nerds, they're mostly satisfied with their iPad experience of not using those expert features. They don't care that the iPad has a very inconsistent, inflexible, difficult to use interface for doing more complex things. You know, and if you try to show them, they mostly bail, but like their satisfaction with the product remains. So I'm not saying that the current compromise is successful, because clearly it's not, but it does have the beneficial characteristic of most of our users will still be satisfied, even as we screw up our ability to do this high end. So it's kind of like the super high end experts are satisfied because it's a video game they can master. Most people are fine because they never have to do that. But then there is like, you're leaving money on the table, and that like these devices, we know these devices could enable people to do more complicated things. And it's just that they're not good at bridging that gap. Like it's one of the things that the Mac was always good at. Hey, you're not a computer expert, but if you sit down in front of this computer and learn some basics, you can be successful at doing things you never thought you could do. And the iPad does that for the low end. Hey, you can browse the web. You can send people email. You can chat with people. You will be successful. If you buy this product, it's not too complicated. You'll figure it out. But that stops. And it's like, you want to do anything more than that, you're going to have serious problems. And unless you want to be a super duper expert, just retreat to the simple things.
I would also, you know, just one final closing thought on like the purity angle here. The history of the iPad is filled with, you know, starting out doing very little, having things very restricted, and then somebody or some third party starts proposing like, hey, you know, what if we, you know, add a keyboard? Although, by the way, Apple shipped a keyboard on day one, but nobody bought it. But like, you know, hey, what if we had a keyboard? What if we make these capacitive stylus things? And you know, yeah, Steve Jobs made fun of styluses a long time ago, but it turns out they're kind of nice. And then eventually, you know, someone does, you know, Microsoft does it or third parties do it, and then eventually, Apple adds their own option. And before Apple does it, everyone's like, no, you should never have a stylus. That would ruin everything. You should never have, you don't need a keyboard. That would make it a laptop. Just buy a laptop, blah, blah, blah. And then Apple does it. They release a new thing. They release their own stylus and it's good. They release their own keyboard and it's good. They, you know, they add multitasking to a system that didn't have multitasking before. And that, you know, is okay. But like eventually the market keeps wanting this device to get more capable. Well, again, although, John, you're right, not all of its market and possibly not even most of its market, but a portion of this market, especially, you know, it's high end for sure, wants these devices to get more capable. And in most cases, the way that has happened is to make them more like laptops. And everyone bitches and moans and complains beforehand. And then somebody allows them, usually Apple, to make it more like a laptop. And everyone's like, Oh yeah, that actually is nice. Like what, and that's for me, that's what changed. Like what changed the iPad for me from a cool toy I kept buying and never using to something I use every day is the keyboard. Like Apple made a really good keyboard for it, and it turns out the difficulty of text input was holding me back quite a lot and discouraging me from using it very often. And once I had better text input via a physical keyboard, I now use it way more. You know, for a lot of people, the pencil did that. You know, where like drawing things on it or, you know, precise input in other styles was difficult or impossible or limited. And the Apple Pencil fixed that and opened up whole new worlds to that kind of use. And, you know, then everyone's like, oh, it should never have a way to browse files. Well, then Apple adds the Files app, which mostly works.
I don't know about that, but I don't want to derail your point.
And then Apple adds the Files app, which occasionally works and kind of does what people want. And
yeah,
you know, and the conceptual purists, when they saw that, were like, why do you need that? It's an iPad. It, you know, just keep data in apps. But no, they added it, and it actually solved a lot of problems and opened up a lot of doors for people. Not well, but you know, it started knocking down some of those walls. And so there's this whole history throughout the entire iPad of people wanting to defend its purity for, you know, ideological sake or for fear that it'll ruin it somehow, make it more complicated. But then eventually Apple does make it more complicated because that's what certain use cases need. And then it's fine. And people, you know, with the exception of a lot of this multitasking stuff that's hard to use because it's weirdly designed and the gestures are all weird, like most of this stuff doesn't have a negative impact on people who want to keep it simple at all. Most of it is simply additive. So if making it a little bit more like laptops here and there has made it so much better for power users and so much more capable of a platform, we shouldn't be afraid of things that are in that direction that sound scary that we haven't tried yet that might have a big impact. Things like, as I said, you know, basic window Chrome. That sounds really weird right now because we don't have it and we haven't seen it. But in 3 years, all iPad apps might have window Chrome by default. They might have a title bar with simple multitasking buttons on the left or whatever, and that might just be fine. And we might look back on the time before that the same way we look back now on the time before the keyboard and the pencil.
Or copy and paste.
Yeah, or copy and paste. Yeah. Making the iPad a little more laptop-like when that is the best solution, which is not never. Like, it's not, it isn't always, but it's not never. When the best solution is to borrow something from the laptop world, the iPad has done it a lot of the time. And there's lots of ways it hasn't. And I'm putting off for now a lot of discussion about the apps themselves and what they can do and what they can't do and various, like, you know, sandboxing issues and file dealing with issues and stuff like that, app store issues. There's a lot of other issues that we could talk about. But just talking about, like, the basics of usability of the device, getting around apps, you know, getting in and out of apps, multitasking, physical interface, borrowing from the laptop world so far has succeeded very well on iPads in the few times they've done it. And so doing it one or two more times for something as rudimentary as, like, the way the multitasking system works, which they've already heavily borrowed from. They already have a dock and an Alt-Tab switcher or Command-Tab switcher. Like, they already have a lot of the same things. You know, the search box. Like, there's a lot of overlap already, and it's worked mostly okay. To borrow a couple more things to make the multitasking system way more easy for anybody who's not Federico to use, I think would go a long way. And we shouldn't rule it out simply because, oh, then why don't you just use a Mac? No, it turns out there's good ideas, and we've already borrowed a lot of them. It wouldn't harm the world to borrow a couple more.
So what we're saying, as usual, is that Microsoft Surface got it right, and their only problem is they started from a crappy desktop operating system, and it's only a matter of time before Apple figures it out and ends up, like, I saw a good graphic recently. It was like, show the Microsoft Surface line, and someone was like, this is what I expected the iPad line to look like by now. It had the giant Surface Studio 27-inch touchscreen thing, and it had the small ones with, they look like laptops with removable screens. And Microsoft has the unified OS strategy of, they have Windows with window Chrome on their tablets, sort of, kind of, like, you know, obviously, you know, starting with Windows was a serious detriment, and I'm not saying Apple should have just put macOS on their tablets, because that would have been the wrong thing too. But what you're describing, Marco, is essentially where Microsoft is now, but with the details different, right? So they, you know, having something that works and looks and borrows a lot from a laptop, but is also a touch device and works in that mode as well, just better. Right, that's what we're looking at. And
details matter.
Like, yeah, the details definitely do matter. There's a reason we're not really using Microsoft Surface. But, you know, the overall strategy, if you didn't look at the details and just described it in broad strokes, that's more or less what you're talking about. And I still contend that, like, ideally you come up with a solution that is better, but if you try for a long time and can't think of anything, it's time to just to consider the menu bar. Like, I would consider the menu bar before window Chrome, actually, because I just feel like it's a simpler element, and you could put one of them up there and they already have a status bar. It's almost like a menu bar anyway, and so on and so forth. But that's the type of stuff you can't just add piecemeal. You have to have a good rethink, right? Just, you know, step back and say, next gen iPad OS, describe the paradigm, and then you can choose which things from the Mac world are we going to pull in. And, you know, if someone says, oh, we don't want to pull that in, it's like, well, then what's your better idea, right? Because we tried these things and they're worse. If you don't have a better idea, it's time to consider, does the menu bar fit in, right? Does a menu bar fit in? Does window Chrome fit in some fashion? And, you know, and so I hope that happens eventually. If it doesn't, I don't think actually it's the end of the world, because I still think that people are generally, most people are satisfied with their iPads using them in simple mode, right? But it also means that the iPad is never going to threaten the Mac for complicated tasks if they can't figure out how to make it, you know, easy to do, you know, make it comfortable and fun and easy for even experts to do on the iPad. It's not. It's too difficult. It's too complicated. And only if you really, really love the iPad will you go through that effort, and everyone else will just run to the thing they're more comfortable with. And we are continuing to make generations of people who are comfortable to some degree doing complicated tasks on desktop computers. So it's not like those people are dying out either. New generations of people know how to use Macs and PCs because they have to use them to do all the things that they generally can't do on an iPad. So that divide will remain, and iPad customers will be happy and Mac customers will be happy. But the future where iPad eventually expands to absorb the problem space of the Mac will never happen if they don't figure this out.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Linode, Bluevine, and Yes Please. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
I didn't get the time to shove it in because we were going long anyway, but I have the opposite of Marco's bug. I had a beginner bug that it is not the result of, but is adjacent to the fact that there is tons of documentation for AppKit. Like AppKit, if you go look at the documentation for some common class in AppKit, there are so many attributes, there are so many methods, and one failure mode is, oh, you didn't see this method or this attribute? Because if you had read it, it's obviously what you want, but it was on a page with 500 methods and you didn't happen to see it. So this bug was, a total dead beginner's bug, but it baffled me for a while. I was just trying to make a window appear and then, let you close it. And then, so I had a menu command, and you pick the menu command and a window appears. And then when you're done with that window, you close it. And then my bug was, all right, so I did it. Select the menu command. I would make a new window. I'd say, window, please show yourself. It would show itself. And then you would close the window. And then I would invoke that same menu command right after that. And it would hit the same code and say, okay, I'm about to show a window. And I tried it both the naive and the quote unquote fancy way. The fancy way was, I don't need to make the window every time. I'll just keep that window around. And the next time they take the menu command, I'll just show it because I already made it, right? Simple, straightforward. The problem was that every time I did the command the second time, the app would crash.
Nice.
Right. And I was in, I'm using Swift here. So I was in the, my great Perl motto, when it's seg faults, it's not your fault, because that's the promise of Perl. It's a high level language. And if it's seg faults, that's not on you. Perl's broken. That's it's a compiler problem. It's not your fault. You shouldn't even be able to do that. Right.
John Syracuse says Perl's broken.
Yeah, but if it's seg faults, that's not your fault, unless you're writing C code to interface with Perl, which you can do. But in general, if you're writing Perl code. So in Swift, I know that's not actually true, but I was having that attitude. And up to this point, I had never had a crashing bug because I'm doing simple things and Swift handles the allocation and everything for it. I'm sure I was making memory leaks here and there, but my apps are so dinky, it doesn't matter anyway. It was. I'm like, what? I'm just making. And so I said, all right, stop trying to be fancy. And just every time they do the command, make the window and ask it to show it. And for some reason, that wasn't working either. And I couldn't, for the life of me, figure out, why does it work the first time, but then the second time, it doesn't. And, AppKit, the thing about AppKit is that there's a long legacy of the way it used to work back in the next days and the early Mac days and so on and so forth. And there's a million different attributes. And so I've been heavily leaning on one of the Slacks I'm in that's filled with you know, vast wealth of experience of Mac development and Next development going back ages. And I'm like, you know, I come in there only with my tail between my legs after I've spent an hour doing this. I'm like, look, I'm just trying to make a window appear and then close and be able to do it a second time. And my app is crashing. What super obvious thing am I missing? And someone with experience said, oh, what you're missing is that unbeknownst to you, every window, every NS window has an attribute called is released after close or something, where and it's set to true by default. So if you show the window and then close it, it's the memory for that window is released behind your back in the system. And that is the correct default for this particular mode working with nibs back in the day, right? But it lives on as an attribute in every single window. And why didn't you know about that? Because if you go to the NS window documentation, which is incredibly extensive, there's a million things there. And if you're not looking for an attribute called is released after close, you'd be like, why is my app crashing? So it would show the window. I would close it. It would release that memory. And the place where it used to be is now just uninitialized garbage memory. And the next time you go and try to do something with that, it crashes. Just
cool.
Isn't this a failure of Arc? Like, shouldn't Arc be holding on to that?
Set is released after close. Well, the is release thing just, you know, ditches the memory for it, and that just causing the bug.
Well, no, dealloc ditches the memory for it. Release just loses a ref count.
I don't know what it actually does. I'm just telling you what the attribute was called. I don't know if I got the name right. It is release after close or something similar. But for all we know, it is dealloking. I don't know what it's doing behind the scenes. All I know is it's an attribute among the many million attributes. I mean, the lesson is don't try to hide and show your own windows. Use NS window controller instead, because it will handle all these things for you. And if you use nibs, this also would be handled for you. Like, this is all the machinery that's behind the scenes that you don't know about, but is a brain-dead simple thing that I'm assuming, I didn't even look up the docs, but I'm assuming totally is documented like everything else. But if you don't know where to look, or you're not familiar with the weird history of how AppKit works and how it works with nibs and how you're supposed to use it, and you try to be like, I know how to make my own window. Well, I'll construct it and ask it to show itself, and it will work great. It does the first time, but then your window is gone.